program of courses and that becomes that were in your house.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll start right off with the agenda of today. That will first take us to look at what lessons could be learned from the South African Bioperspective Framework, because they had to grapple with certain number of common issues, not entirely the same, of course, but there's also some similarities. The definition of an indigenous community. The benefit sharing, how does it operate? So we will start off by presentation of Johanna on this issue, and then we will follow a bit more on the management of rights issue that we had spoken about yesterday. How do you manage the rights between the communities, the designated authority, what are the different models for that? And that will be kindly presented by Kabir Akbati, who has joined us today. From Natural Justice, and we're very grateful for his presence also with us, because he came yesterday from a very long trip, and we're very happy to have him with us. Thank you. Joanna?
Good morning, everybody, and apologies for a little delay. So to follow up from yesterday, the idea was, because some of the things you already talked about, so I'm going to skip some of the issues a little bit faster because you mentioned them yesterday, but the idea is to just look to what extent the South African Bioprospecting Legal Framework provides some useful inputs to some of the discussions that are going on with respect to this particular bill. Now, the Bioprospecting Framework doesn't work perfectly, but at least they've been grappling with a lot of these issues, and it might be quite useful to look at some of them. The origin of the Act, as we had, you know, based the follow-up from yesterday's discussion about where internationally these issues are being dealt with, comes very much from the discussions under the Convention on Biological Diversity and Access and Benefit Sharing discussions that also Olivier gave a bit more background on yesterday. In the actual negotiations of the CBD, South Africa wasn't actually that active, but then became really involved in the follow-up discussions on how an international regime and access and benefit sharing could look like. These discussions are taking place under the Department of Environmental Affairs, and the basic framework is set by three pieces. One is the Biodiversity White Paper from 1997, then the National Environmental Management and Biodiversity Act from 2004, and the subsequent regulations of 2008. Something quick about the process. The development of this framework took a very long time and a very long and broad consultation process. The white paper itself took 2 years, the Act took 7 years in the making, and then the regulations, they actually had three national workshops, they had different provinces participating, they had representatives from national provincial governments, but also research institutions, a range of traditional healers, organizations that were all part of this of the consultations that then led up to the regulations. They had written inputs, and in total they had 15 drafts that led up to the final regulations that we have today. If you, as an overview, just briefly, the Act basically what it does is to say that in order to do bioprospecting in South Africa on South African resources involving South African traditional knowledge, you need to have a permit. Without a permit, you cannot engage in such activities. And such permits will only be disclosed will only be given to an applicant once this applicant has disclosed to the stakeholders what the research is about and has got the consent of such stakeholders. These consent must also not just be on the consent of the research itself, but also must include a benefit sharing agreement and a material transfer agreement where it actually deals with material. The regulations then put basically the Minister of Environmental Affairs in charge of this framework, which was recently changed to the Deputy Minister, and also makes a differentiation between different phases of research. So if you're in the discovery phase of research, the regulations are still somewhat looser, and only once you reach the commercial phase of research, you actually have to have a permit in place. That was a recent amendment, and it reflected some of the complications that existed, particularly for scientists who are saying, well, it is really difficult for us to decide how we're going to share benefits as we're still in the very beginning of our research and we actually don't know what type of benefits they might accrue. So it makes much more sense to only enter into an agreement once we are much closer to understanding what is the commercial possibility of this research. The regulations also specify that foreigners can only apply for a permit in combination with a South African legal entity, which is quite important. And then they're obliged to regularly update the minister. And another thing, what the regulations do is to provide all of the forms that you need, particularly with respect to benefit sharing, which is something that I mentioned yesterday. And it mentions a range of the possibilities of benefit. So it's quite helpful for any applicant. Now, we also mentioned yesterday that traditional knowledge protection in the international UN agency is somewhat segregated between different forms of traditional knowledge. In this particular act, it covers traditional knowledge that is in relation or what they call associated to indigenous biological resources, and that is obviously relevant for bioprospecting. It doesn't protect broader forms of traditional knowledge. With respect to the actual model of protection, it's quite interesting. Yesterday we talked about the management of rights. Now, in this particular case, the state, above all, takes some sort of an oversight role. But the regulations, what they cover is, above all, the relationship between the user of traditional knowledge and the provider of traditional knowledge, where a permit system goes through the state, but actually the type of benefits, whether the consent is given or not, is very much in the hand of the community. So the state or the competent authority takes to some extent a step back and really ensures that the relationship between the user and the provider is done according to the framework. But it doesn't get very involved in terms of how the benefit should look like, what the benefit should be spent upon. That's very much in the hand of the community. So on top of that, the framework provides both a defensive as well as a positive protection, in the sense that if communities actually have an interest to commercialize their knowledge, they can do so through the framework. Now, in terms of some of the definitions that we have, the definition of traditional knowledge in the legislation refers to traditional use or knowledge, which is defined as the customary utilization or knowledge of indigenous biological resources by an indigenous community in accordance with written or unwritten rules, usage, customs or practices traditionally observed, accepted and recognized by them, including discoveries about indigenous biological resources. Now, the advantage of a definition like that is that there's no fixation needed, there is no originality requirement, it's perpetual, and it's open-ended, in the sense that some of the complications that we talked about yesterday with respect to the amendment bill is that it is much more holistic definition of traditional knowledge that is not then limited in terms of some of the classifications of the intellectual property forms of protection that would be a challenge with such a definition. The definition of a community again is defined as a group of people or community of people that are living or having rights and interests in a distinct geographical area with a leadership structure and whose traditional knowledge and use of the indigenous biological resource has contributed to the bioprospecting. So here the definition is linked to a geographical area, but also to a joint use and knowledge, and above all to a joint leadership structure. Now the challenges, of course, is, you know, Who is this? How do you identify the leadership? How do you know who is the leader in this community? How do you deal, as we also mentioned yesterday, how do you deal with communities who might classify for this definition but actually cross national borders? And how do you identify who within a community should benefit? Is it a group of the healers that are represented in the community? Should it be the entire community? And so these are some of the challenges that are also coming up with respect to this particular act. One of the ways they try to deal with it is to come up with a community resolution, in the sense that it says if you enter into an agreement with a community, it is not enough to just say this is the community, but there has to be a resolution provided by the community that outlines their structure and defines how do they organize themselves and who represents them in the negotiation. So to some extent, the ball is then thrown back to the community and say, you actually define yourself, you define who should benefit from this particular usage. With respect to ownership of traditional knowledge, in the Act you have the possibility of collective ownership as well as individual ownership. The individual ownership was a recent amendment, and it was a response to a large range of individual traditional herbalists or healers coming to CSIR where they presented some of their knowledge. And the ownership is also open-ended in the Act. Another issue with respect to traditional knowledge. Now, the ownership of indigenous biological resources is something that we discussed yesterday. Is a challenge in the sense that in the international framework, as we discussed, where there is a discussion on whether genetic resources are owned by the state or who would have basically the ownership of the genetic heritage of a plant, whereas in the South African Act, this is very much linked to land rights. So any landowner can actually give access to the plants on the land in order to provide access for the research. Now, this is something that has not been resolved in South Africa, mostly as a result of some potential constitutional conflicts with respect to land rights and the decision of who owns genetic resources in South Africa. There's actually a lot of there's some papers written about that, which I can provide if anybody's interested. Some of the challenges that emerged also with ownership of traditional knowledge with respect to this Act is it is silent with respect to how do you deal with traditional knowledge that is broadly known, like knowledge that we have on rooibos, for example, which was a recent case, where actually it's so broadly used and there's so much understanding about some of the values that rooibos has. How do you then link it to a particular community? And if you want to do research with respect to a plant like that, how do you who should benefit from that? That's something that came up is currently under discussion with a case where Nestle has engaged in bioprospecting on rooibos and honeybush without getting the appropriate permit, and they're currently discussing with the Environmental Affairs Department in order to get an appropriate permit. But what is not clear is who would be the beneficiary in respect to both providing access to the genetic resource or to the biological resource in South Africa, whether it's the landowner who actually provided it, but what about the broader availability of rooibos and also the traditional knowledge? It is not clear yet who will be the beneficiary, and I think that's something that they're currently grappling with. One thing that is possibly a solution to, not a solution, but it helps a little bit, is that traditional knowledge ownership is not exclusive in the sense that only because one community enters into an agreement with one potential bioprospector doesn't mean that another community cannot do the same. So that's to some extent provides some way out, but it's not necessarily a solution, and it's something that is still being decided. I believe the Department of Science and Technology are hoping to also provide some input into how do you deal with plants like Wuhu as well, where they're so broad knowledge available in South Africa and you can't link it to one particular community. Now, with respect to the benefits from traditional knowledge, the framework divides between monetary benefits and non-monetary benefits. And in terms of monetary benefits, also provides establishes a trust fund through which all of the monetary benefits out of the agreements would have to go. But the how the money will be spent will then be decided by the community. So the trust fund is like an administrative support, if you want, in terms of the management of the resources.
So how the money is used?
Is used, yeah. The fund is managed by the DG, who is also accountable for the fund itself. And what defines how the money is spent is also included in the benefit sharing agreement then. Any surplus money, as it's defined by the Act, would then go into conservation-related research and capacity development of the communities. The framework also provides for non-monetary benefits and has a specific section that deals with local and indigenous communities and some particular benefits that would be useful for them in terms of regular information. They make sure that there's printed reports and not copies and posters, so something that translates a little bit more to some of the particular needs of communities in order to be aware of what's going on with respect to the ongoing research. All of this can be found in the regulations. Now, another issue that is interesting is the question about how do you deal with traditional knowledge that is in the public domain. The framework actually doesn't make a distinction between traditional knowledge that is still secret and traditional knowledge that is in the public domain. And basically says only because something is known doesn't mean that you have the right to use it, and distinguishes to some extent between, and I think Kabir will talk more about this, what is publicly available and what is in the public domain are two different things. Only because you can have access to it doesn't mean that it's a free-for-all thing. So basically it doesn't, even though something is known, still would mean that you would have to go through the act in order to get a permit. Now the challenge of that is, of course, how do you know who owns the traditional knowledge? If you, maybe there's lots of books written about the medicinal use of certain plants, and there's no description about where actually this knowledge comes from. So that is a challenge, and a lot of researchers are complaining about it and saying, well, are we then in charge to find out where originally this traditional knowledge comes from? Is that something that you can realistically do as a researcher or as a company that is interested? Again, that is something where they're looking into input from the department or from SUNBI or any agent or any institution that could provide some leadership in this, and that's something that they're currently grappling with. Finally, with respect to enforcement, the Act does carry criminal measures for breaking the regulations in terms of both jail term as well or monetary fines, with increased fines for second convictions. It also tries to address the issue of retroactivity, not so much of the use of indigenous biological resources in the past that have already been finalized, but those that are still ongoing are covered by the Act, in the sense that it basically calls for a 6-month transition phase within which all ongoing forms of bioprospecting would have to go through the department to apply for a permit. Some of that was, I believe, a bit ambitious, and they're still very much challenged with getting information about what are the ongoing bioprospecting activities, and a lot of them have not submitted permit applications. So that's something they're also still grappling with. So this was just to give a little bit of an overview about how some of these issues are being dealt with in the bioprospecting framework and some of the challenges they face, but also some of the useful definitions they provided with that. Do you want to go straight? Yeah, do you want to go straight? I think we're going to go straight into Kabir's because it's kind of connected, and then we can take some questions after.
Thank you. Thank you, Johanna. Just to give a brief introduction of myself, my name is Kabir Bavikate. I'm a lawyer and one of the directors of a South African legal not-for-profit called Natural Justice. Natural Justice is essentially a group of lawyers, and we work on a range of issues, but primarily focusing on community rights to biodiversity and knowledge. And essentially, the focus of our work is to be able to kind of look at best practice at a community level and to ensure that this informs national law and policy making and international law and policy making. So we work as primarily an interfaith organization that looks at how law and policy making can be impacted by processes that happen within communities, and these processes being best practice processes. What I'm going to try and do is to follow up from what Johanna spoke about, because essentially Johanna was contextualizing this whole discussion around protection of traditional knowledge. So the example that Johanna gave was an example from an area where most amount of work has now been done around protection of traditional knowledge, which is essentially traditional knowledge that is related to biological diversity. So you've got, internationally, you have negotiations that have been going on for a number of years now under the Convention on Biological Diversity, but specifically linked to a protocol on access and benefit sharing. And within this protocol, there is a clear recognition of community rights to traditional knowledge that is related to the use of genetic resources. And the South African legislation that Johanna spoke about is essentially something that seeks to translate these international processes into national law. So when we look at the South African Biodiversity Act, what it seeks to do is to secure community rights to the traditional knowledge associated with the use of genetic resources. Now, obviously, there are clear limits to what can be done within the framework of the CBD, that is the Convention on Biological Diversity, because the convention recognizes the rights of communities to their traditional knowledge. And this recognition of rights is a very explicit recognition of rights. The convention says that communities have rights over their traditional knowledge, which essentially means the right to give prior informed consent before the use of the traditional knowledge by commercial or research interests, and the right to partake in any benefits that would be generated from the use of such knowledge. So what we're looking at here when it comes to traditional knowledge that is related to biodiversity is a notion of direct reciprocity, where you are talking about communities that are not just stakeholders but rights holders who have specific rights over their traditional knowledge. And they therefore have a right to consent to the use of their traditional knowledge by anyone who does not belong to that particular community, and have a right to share benefits that are generated from the use of such knowledge. Now, this is a particular model which is very different from the kind of model that we're looking at within the bill here that is under discussion. Because within the bill, the approach is that the state acts as the parent patria, which is almost like the father of the people, so to speak, where the state says that we will give consent for the use of traditional knowledge on behalf of communities. And whatever benefits that are generated would be paid into a fund, and the state will decide how these benefits will be shared in the interest of the indigenous peoples of South Africa. So, in one sense, one is moving away from an approach of direct reciprocity to an approach where the state, at some level, is the custodian of traditional knowledge. While communities could be owners of traditional knowledge, the state becomes the custodian, and the state becomes the consent giver, and the state becomes the recipient of any royalties that are generated, and therefore the state decides how to disburse the royalties for the benefit of communities. Now, I mean, the history of a lot of this discussion around protection of traditional knowledge, and I think Graham is going to go more into this, is at some level a history that that seeks to protect. I mean, that seeks to protect traditional knowledge that has, at some level, been, as what Johanna said, which has been in the public domain, which at some level has been taken out of the public domain and has been appropriated through instruments of intellectual property rights. So there is, if you can imagine a kind of a pyramid, at the bottom or the broadest section of the pyramid, what you have is traditional knowledge that is broadly in the public domain, but essentially it's also traditional knowledge that has been used and shared by communities within and between communities. And increasingly what you have is the narrowing of that, because it seems to be taken out of this kind of a common pool and increasingly appropriated or privatized, where there are innovations or there are new models that are based on this traditional knowledge, but essentially these are locked into narrower and narrower intellectual property kind of model. So essentially then what you have is almost something that is being taken out of a certain common pool and being used in ways that is not necessarily how it is used in the common pool, and also simultaneously being appropriated in ways where the outcomes of this upscaling, or the outcomes of this kind of research or commercial development that happens, which is based on this traditional knowledge, is again not freely available. So in one sense, there was this problem, and at the same time, the other impetus for the protection of traditional knowledge has been the whole movement for the rights of indigenous peoples and local communities, and which has essentially said that it is critical. I mean, especially when you're looking at international law, you're looking at the General Assembly resolution on the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and clearly there is great emphasis that communities have rights over their knowledge, innovations, and practices. And at some level, these rights have to be recognized. And it just doesn't mean that knowledge can be used simply because it is community knowledge. And so then there is this whole move for communities to set the terms of how their knowledge will be used. But here, I'd like to come to my first slide. I mean, the challenge with anything that is communally developed and communally owned, whether one is talking about biological resources or whether one is talking about traditional knowledge, is the notion of what exactly is this community that we're speaking about. Now, as far as the National Biodiversity Act is concerned and the regulations that relate to it, it says, of course, we're talking about a group of people who are living in South Africa, but the Act also adds that they should have a certain common leadership structure. Now, as far as the bill is concerned, the bill essentially refers to a particular group of people or any group of people who live in South Africa. This is a really, really broad understanding of what constitutes a community. Now, discussions internationally are fraught with debates that have gone on who exactly is a community for the purposes of protection of traditional knowledge. But it could be a group of people with shared ethnicity, it could be a group of people with shared values, it could be a group of people with a certain common cause, it could be a group of people with collective decision making. But in one sense, the discussions are something that generate a list of possible indicators that define what a community is. Now, the kind of community we speak about in the bill is a fairly open-ended kind of a definition, where it says any group of people who live in South Africa. So, and at the same time, with such a broad understanding of the notion of the community, there is equally a broad understanding of what exactly is traditional knowledge. And that itself, again, I mean, the bill says, I mean, traditional knowledge is essentially what is recognized by the indigenous community as traditional. So essentially what you have is a group of people, and this group of people recognizes something as traditional. So that would, at least technically speaking for the purposes of the Act, be considered traditional knowledge. And traditional knowledge, of course, is not static, but it's dynamic, it's constantly growing. So it seems that the only requirement then for legitimacy is the recognition that this is traditional by a particular indigenous community. So you've got a fairly wide and open-ended understanding of what constitutes traditional knowledge. Within this framework, So we want to protect this guy, this knowledge. Now, within this framework, it's important to ask the question of why exactly do we want to protect this? I mean, what is the impetus for protection? Now, the protection... Now, the protection could either be aspirational, and in the case of the bill, we're looking at the possibility of generating royalties. Okay, so it's an economic opportunity where if anyone would like to use some of the traditional knowledge which is within the database that the bill seeks to set up, then they would need to give a portion of the royalties back to the fund. And so in one sense, there is this possibility of generating royalties. And there is also the push towards it being defensive. That is, to prevent the appropriation of this traditional knowledge. So here you have a situation where the idea of defensive essentially is that the bill says that, well, you can go ahead and use this traditional knowledge as much as you want, as long as you're not using it for any commercial purpose. But the moment you seek to derive commercial benefits from it, then you would need to be able to share benefits with... You would need to share benefits with the fund that is being set up. So, the bill essentially, of course, I mean, the amendment bill raises the question of who benefits from the opportunities and who sets the terms of the use? Because this takes us back to the earlier point that I made. Essentially, what we're talking about here is we're saying that the state, because this whole notion of community is a difficult concept to kind of deal with, and under the Biodiversity Act, we've had challenges of identifying who exactly are the rights holders of a particular traditional knowledge. For example, if one is looking at the traditional knowledge relating to the Hoodia, you would say, well, the San community in South Africa says that we are the primary rights holders. But then you also have the Nama community, which says, well, we have also used this particular knowledge. So in one sense, the idea of assigning specific rights to a particular community relating to traditional knowledge that is widely used becomes challenging. And therefore, what the bill seeks to do is to be able to circumvent that by saying that essentially, knowledge is held by the state, and therefore you would have to share benefits with the state. So, but the challenge, of course, is that there is an issue of rights, and who sets the terms of this particular use of traditional knowledge? A lot of this knowledge, in one sense, is complex. Aspects of it could be sacred. Aspects of it could be strictly cultural and used only for certain purposes. Are there any terms on the basis of which there will be conditions of how this knowledge should be used? But there is none such. And in one sense, the big question is, does the community who contributes this particular knowledge to be recorded in the database, would the community be able to set any terms for how it should be used? Would the community be able to receive direct benefits from the use of the knowledge? And in one sense, the bill that we're talking about here circumvents it. It says that, well, the issue of community is relatively complex, so we leave it out of this, and the state will decide, and the state will give permission to use, and the state will receive the benefits. Now, this was a point that Johanna kind of raised previously, which I will kind of deal with in a bit of greater detail. Now, if knowledge at some level is secret, or if it is held by a small group of people, then there is no issue here. There is no need at some level to be able to protect it through this particular bill. Because the notion of an indigenous community is defined so widely, you could have the same group of people who come together and form a company and say that, well, we have this particular knowledge, it is a secret knowledge, and we are willing to enter into an agreement with a potential researcher or with a potential commercial interest. And we will kind of look at an issue of direct reciprocity, where we will get benefits from it. The challenge comes in when you're talking about the issue of knowledge that is in the public domain. And public domain is a fairly broad term, and of course, definitions of what is the public domain varies. But essentially, if the particular knowledge that we're speaking about here is knowledge that has already been out there in the media or in books or in magazines, or that people are aware of it through conversations with community members, it isn't secret in one sense. It would broadly be considered as knowledge in the public domain. So here you have a situation where the state says that if knowledge is in the public domain, then it becomes very hard to be able to identify who the progenitors of this particular knowledge is. So essentially you have a particular group of people who come up and say, well, this is our knowledge, we want it recorded in the database. And when therein is the matter. So in one sense, this particular knowledge is protected, so no one can appropriate this knowledge and say that this is my knowledge and therefore I will perhaps get a patent out on it, or I will get a copyright out on it, and I will generate benefits for myself. But rather the state says that we have documented it, this is traditional knowledge in the public domain, and therefore you can use it, but you can use it with the consent of the state, and for which you will have to share a certain percentage of the royalties with the fund that we set up for this particular purpose. Now, on the other hand, you have, I mean, internationally, we have indigenous peoples and local communities who have strongly fought for this idea of what one calls publicly available knowledge. So the point that communities are making is that unlike traditional, I mean, intellectual property rights law, we exercise rights over our knowledge in perpetuity. We're not talking about 50 years yet. This is our knowledge, and we exercise rights over it in perpetuity. The mere fact that other people know about it does not necessarily mean, therefore, that it is free use, or does not necessarily mean that we have no rights over it. But instead, we would say that this is publicly available, which essentially means it's like listening to a song on the radio. Anyone can listen to a song on the radio, but it doesn't mean that you can take the song and do exactly what you want with it. There is someone who owns the copyright over that song, and so if you listen to it and if you'd like to create a remix of that particular song, you need permission from the copyright holder. And likewise, that's precisely what the song said. They said, well, the knowledge of the Hoodia is something that is publicly available. Yes, a lot has been written about this knowledge in books and in journals, and in anthropological accounts. But that does not mean that the knowledge doesn't belong to us. It's out there. We have always shared and freely exchanged it. But we will set the terms of this particular use, and you would have to ask us permission if you would like to commercialize this particular knowledge. Therefore, it is publicly available. But we will issue a license to you on how to use this particular knowledge, under what terms, and what we would like in exchange. So here you have a community that is exercising rights over the knowledge, and it says that we would like a degree of direct reciprocity. We would like to be able to set the terms. We would like benefits from the use of this particular knowledge. So, but of course, the bill at hand, the problem seems to be that this process is difficult. It is messy, and the experience under the Biodiversity Act and the Bioprospecting and Access and Benefit Sharing Regulations in South Africa has shown that it takes effort. It takes effort to be able to recognize who the community is that is the holder of this particular traditional knowledge, who has to give consent. I mean, between the San and the Nama, for example, the debate is who is the primary rights holder versus who is the secondary rights holder. Merely because the community came, say, 300 years later, would that necessarily mean that they have less rights over this knowledge than a community that came before them? But, I mean, at some point in time, it gets extremely complicated. So therefore, to avoid this, the state says, well, you know, it is publicly available, but we will recognize it, but we will give permission, and it becomes a part of the common pool that is held by the state. There are similar problems when we're looking at setting up the database under the bill. So there are different kinds of databases that are set up in different parts of the world when one is talking about databases for traditional knowledge. I mean, one could be where communities contribute to this particular database. The other could be that the state goes up and starts collecting. For example, in India, the traditional knowledge digital library, a lot of the work has been done by the state itself. The state goes ahead and collects the traditional knowledge, and then it puts it in a database. Now, the Indian model of the traditional knowledge digital library is primarily defensive. I mean, unlike the South African model that is being set up under the bill, within the Indian model, the database is not a public document. No, I mean, the access to the database, only the government has access to the database, and the intellectual property offices in the other countries. So essentially, the database is there to establish what is called prior art. It's a defensive database. So you have, for example, an application before the U.S. Patent Office, which says, okay, this is an application for a patent for the particular use of a plant. The patent examiner has direct access to the traditional knowledge digital library in India. They will check to see if this knowledge is traditional knowledge, it was already out there, and at some level, what is being claimed as an inventive step, is it really an inventive step, or is it just a cut and paste from traditional knowledge that already existed? So here you have something that is purely for defensive purposes. It is there to ensure that what is in the public domain is there in the public domain, to maintain the integrity of this knowledge that is freely available, to ensure that it is not appropriated by private parties. So it's not a public document. It is there for a very specific purpose. On the other hand, under the Biodiversity Act in India, which is similar to the Biodiversity Act in South Africa, which is linked to access and benefit sharing, you have another model called the PBRs, which is the People's Biodiversity Registers. The People's Biodiversity Register becomes a community-led model where you've got what is called the village panchayats or the Gram Sabhas, which is the lowest unit of governance, which actively sets up a biodiversity committee, which goes about connecting this knowledge from communities. So that results in the formation of a People's Biodiversity Register, which is kept within this kind of lowest, which is kept by this lowest unit of governance. But at the same time, the communities have rights over the knowledge which is collected in the People's Biodiversity Register. So you may have someone who applies to the National Biodiversity Authority in India, who says, I would like to use some of the traditional knowledge of Community X. I've heard about this particular knowledge for the development of a phytopharmaceutical product. Then what you're supposed to have technically within the People's Biodiversity Register model is that the community that has contributed that particular knowledge is then contacted and asked to give consent for that use of that knowledge, and there is a negotiation that occurs between the community and the prospective user of that knowledge. Here again, you have a situation where the state enters to help the community document its traditional knowledge, and therefore it constitutes a degree of defensive protection, but the community still has rights to set the terms of that use and still can claim it to be the direct beneficiary of benefits generated from the use of this knowledge. The challenge, of course, is who decides, in one sense, whether traditional knowledge is in the public domain or not. And this becomes quite an interesting challenge, because ultimately, the Traditional Knowledge Amendment Bill is triggered when knowledge is in the public domain. If knowledge is not in the public domain, then the bill does not apply. If the knowledge is secret, the bill does not apply. But this becomes a tricky question. You could have, I mean, we could give an example of a group of traditional healers. I mean, there is a Traditional Healers Association with a membership of about 200 people in Bushbuckridge municipality. Now, this Traditional Healers Association shares traditional knowledge amongst themselves. So a number of healers have some of their own distinct knowledge sets, that some of them say that they have received this knowledge from their ancestors, others say that they've received this knowledge from their teachers, and at the same time, there is also a common pool of knowledge that they share amongst themselves. Now, as a result of the formation of this particular association, the healers have now begun to exchange amongst themselves knowledge that was previously privately held. Now, say for example, you have healer X, who has some traditional knowledge that was exclusively known by her. She in turn shares it with the healers association so that the other healers could also use it. Now, one of the healers in the healers association
decides to perhaps go and publicize this particular knowledge. Now, in one sense, does that make that knowledge in the public domain? Does the fact that that knowledge is shared now by about 200 other traditional healers, does that ensure that make the knowledge in the public domain? At what point in time does the individual with the knowledge actually lose rights over that knowledge under the bill? And that becomes a huge challenge when one is talking about this particular idea of public domain. And lastly, we have a system of a trust fund that is being developed under the bill. And now, the interesting thing about the trust fund is that it takes the approach of new and continued uses. Now, it deals with the challenge of what is called retroactivity in law. Now, retroactivity in law, I mean, as you're aware, is to say that, fine, I mean, you cannot penalize a person for something that they did prior to the law actually having come into force. So in this particular case, you could have someone using traditional knowledge, and at some level, once the law kicks in, you can't go up to the person and say, now you have to share royalties for all the profits that you earned prior to the entry into force of the law. But what the law does is that it targets what are called new and continuing uses. So it says, fine, whatever you generated prior to the entry into force of the law is yours. But after the law comes into force, any further profits that you make, well, you will have to give a percentage of royalties to the trust fund. And at some level, any new uses that you have, you would have to, again, you know, negotiate with the trust fund. I mean, you would actually have to kind of negotiate with the trust fund as to what percentage of royalties you would need to pay to the fund. Now, but under the Biodiversity Act in South Africa, you've got the Bioprospecting Trust Fund. And the Bioprospecting Trust Fund is a very segmented trust fund in the sense that here we're talking about the state receiving benefits on behalf of specific communities. So I could be a community X in the sense, for example, the Bushbuckridge Traditional Healers Association. And I could enter into an agreement with a local company for the use of my traditional knowledge. And we have a benefit-sharing agreement. And based on that benefit-sharing agreement, we could say 10% of all profits that are generated from the commercialized product based on the traditional knowledge will be given to the Traditional Healers Association. If that's the case, then that 10% will have to be lodged in the Bioprospecting Trust Fund. But it will be lodged under the name of the Bushbuckridge Traditional Healers Association. And then what happens is that the state, or the fund in this case, is responsible for ensuring payment directly to that particular community. So here you have a segmented kind of a trust fund where each community has at some level rights to its money is going in. But again, with the bill, because there is a need to kind of avoid the complexity of traditional knowledge that is kind of widely held and the challenge of identifying who community owners are, it says that it's a common pool trust fund. All the money goes into the trust fund. It's not in any community's name, and the state decides how this money will be spent for the well-being of the indigenous communities in the country. Now, that is perhaps, I mean, clearly what I'm trying to do here is I'm not trying to say that one model is better than the other. I mean, there are, both models exist internationally. For example, you have the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, which tries to do something similar, where, you know, people contribute the different kinds of land races or agricultural varieties that have been developed into this particular common pool of genetic resources for food and agriculture. And everyone can have access to it. I mean, the idea of creating a common pool is to ensure that everyone has access to it. And if at some level certain commercial benefits are generated, a certain percentage of these benefits go into a fund, and that fund is used for farmers in different parts of the world. So in one sense, the idea is something has to go back to communities, but it doesn't have to be a specific community. Now, the challenges. Now, we've spoken about two models for protection of traditional knowledge. We've got a rights-based approach where we're talking about specific communities having certain rights to set terms and receive benefits. And we've got a protection-based model where you say the primary idea is not to secure the rights of individual communities, but to protect this kind of a common pool of knowledge that we have in this country, that no one is able to appropriate this. And if there are benefits generated from it, great, and that benefits will be used for all communities. So we can look at four possible models here. I mean, the first model is the model which you see in the traditional knowledge digital library model in India, where the state says, well, we own all knowledge in the public domain, and we want to keep it in the public domain. So it's a defensive model which says, the reason why we are creating a database is we don't want people to take stuff from the public domain and appropriate it. We want to keep this common pool sacred, and therefore the state owns all the knowledge here, and the state acts on behalf of the people. The second model is that the state says that, well, we own all the knowledge, and we also want to profit from its use. And in one sense, that to some extent is the South African model, where the state says, the fund, at some level, owns the copyrights, as far as traditional knowledge is concerned. And royalties will go back to the fund, and the fund will be used for the people. But the idea is that if I, as a South African, would like to use some of this traditional knowledge commercially, it's not. I just can't go ahead and do it. I will have to negotiate a benefit-sharing agreement with the fund, where I say, this is the percentage of profits I will pay back to the fund. Thirdly, you have the model where communities own their knowledge and set the terms for access and benefit sharing. This is the kind of model that the Biodiversity Act of South Africa uses, when it says the state steers clear from getting into who owns what amongst communities. This is something that the communities have to work out amongst themselves. It is a particularly challenging model, but it's a model that seeks to recognize rights. So here you have a situation where, as Johanna pointed out, a standard benefit-sharing agreement with a community has to be accompanied by a resolution from the community that authorizes its leadership to enter into this agreement on its behalf. The community, of course, is asserting rights over that particular knowledge, and it will set the terms of access and benefit-sharing. Now, there have been situations where three or four communities can collectively own that knowledge. These communities could be spread out across the country. But under the Biodiversity Act, the understanding is that Community X can enter into an agreement with Company Y, and that is not a problem, as long as the agreement is non-exclusive, which means that Community Z, which also shares that knowledge, can enter into a similar agreement with Company A. The idea is that all communities that share that knowledge don't have to come together in order to enter into the agreement. You can have different communities that enter into separate agreements for the use of that same traditional knowledge with different companies, as long as these agreements don't affect the rights of other communities that share this knowledge from entering into similar agreements. So it's an issue of non-exclusivity. I mean, that's the way they've dealt with the challenge of the fact that knowledge could be widely spread. It is that different communities are free to enter into agreements. I mean, that's how it would work. The last kind of a model is a community knowledge commons that foregrounds community values of knowledge sharing. I mean, this, in one sense, is an emerging model that people who have been working on access to knowledge are kind of emphasizing on, where it says that there are certain terms on the basis of which knowledge is used and shared by communities. These terms are broadly non-appropriation, free sharing, and essentially the idea is that within and between communities, knowledge has always been shared under certain conditions. I mean, the very act of sharing itself kind of builds relationships within and between communities. So knowledge is actually not just something like a commodity, but it's almost a relationship people have with each other. So the Community Knowledge Commons model essentially says, what are the core values of how this knowledge is shared? And if the core values, I mean, and this has been identified through some studies, if the core values are at some level reciprocity, if the core value is the fact that if you have received the knowledge share freely, then and if you develop that particular knowledge and come out with a new knowledge, then you too will share that new knowledge freely. You will not take something that has been given to you freely and appropriate it, but rather you will take it, which that you will take it as something that has come out of the public domain, and you will put whatever developments that you have made back into the public domain. You will not appropriate this. So in one sense, what the Community Knowledge Commons model says is that it says that the biggest problem here is a problem that something is taken out of a common pool and appropriated. But if you can lay down conditions saying that if whatever you take out of the common pool and whatever developments you make on this, you will return back to the common pool and allow others to freely use it, then that is really what we're looking for. And then that becomes a Community Knowledge Commons model where you could have a large database as you have where the state sets up this particular database. Communities that contribute the knowledge to that database can set certain terms for its use, saying these aspects of our traditional performances are sacred. We would not want it to be used in certain ways that profane some of the values that we have. These kind of conditions. But after that, you could say that anyone who kind of uses it will not get a copyright on it. I mean, say for example, I use this particular song, and then I have a remix on this particular song. Therefore, I will not be allowed to take a copyright out on my remix, but rather my remix will also be freely available for other people to use it, to make other kinds of remixes of this song. So what it then does is that it creates a kind of an expanding pool of common space where everyone can freely use and everyone freely shares. And this model essentially is that access is itself benefit sharing. The fact that everybody in society has access to it and will continue to have access to new developments based on this common pool itself is a benefit for everyone. So these are the broad kind of four models that we're looking at. I'll stop there and we can open it up for questions. Thank you so much.
I take it then, Mr. Lateef, this gives us the opportunity to ask questions on both. Right.
Yes.
That is both Dr. Braun and, of course, Mr. Babakat. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Now, members, you've heard the presentation, so are there any questions or comments? I really appreciated the way you used the time yesterday and didn't raise preambles. So are there any questions or comments on my right here? That is this side. Do you have any questions or comments? Yes, Mr. Albert. On my left, Mr. Jikalana, and then also then further on my left, we have Oriani Ambrosini and Mr. Maria Four. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to know your opinion on the various models that you've shown us. Given South Africa's complex mix of peoples, what would you think would be the best model, in your view, to apply here? The community's leaders themselves, the state they control, or maybe even a mix of the two? Thank you.
Mr. Njikalana.
Thanks, Chair. Well, this is getting, you know, illustrative day by day or hour by hour. Very exciting, but also quite very complex. You know, very complex, but exciting. The first thing is that I hope at some stage, you know, there will be a little bit of more elaboration, not verbally, but in terms of writing, on the comparison between the Indian model and ours, in terms of the use of direct and indirect rights. You know, it's actually very striking to see ourselves, so because of in both situations, the state is involved, and in both situations, it states that really are as democratic as they aspire to be. I'll emphasize that because I think the ease of the democratic content in intellectual property, you know, plays a very crucial role. But beyond that, benefits. It was striking that you actually, through you mentioned, you know, for commercial and non commercial benefits, if I can stretch it to that level. Can you just rehash that, you know? What would we see, you know, even Professor Latif, in terms of non-commercial benefits? You know, you see, the thing is, my understanding is that one of the things that we are basked in or entangled in this protracted struggle, both nationally and even globally, is because there are always commercial interests. So I get suspicious about what could be seen as non-commercial benefits. But what if at the end they end up, you know, being actually commercial in answer, in essence? But I'm just provocative on that. Model of rights and protection, the input right at the end. Can I also say once again, provoke again, that I appreciate the four models, though I'm still trying to grapple the fourth one, a little bit complex. However, let me put this one. Would you see this as a model of its own, or would it fall in amongst all those four models, whereby I'm saying, one, the state monitors and facilitates direct distribution of benefits to the beneficiary community. It collects whatever benefits, the funds, monies, and whatever. But what it does is that it does that for the sake of ensuring that there is appropriate and fair and equitable, you know, sharing of those benefits by whichever beneficiary community. And the other angle of it is that it ensures the protection of the rights. Whilst it may allow the very communities, but it says, look, I'll double up and ensure that your rights are protected. Thank you.
Mr. Ariane Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. At the outset, apologies for not having been here yesterday. I was abroad on a party political trip. And apologies for arriving late. I need, indulge with me, Madam Chairman, I need some clarity because all this is very difficult to my mind. And I need to have clarity in the sign of precision. The first issue is the relationship between international law and municipal law.
You mean national law or municipal?
No, sorry, between international law and municipal law. My reading, municipal law means national law. My reading is that there is no extant international obligation which requires us as legislature to adopt a single provision in this bill. I pulled up I was looking at now the Convention on Biodiversity, or the Biological Diversity Convention, and I cannot find anything. I'm quite familiar with the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and I cannot relate any of the language there to what we have here. If I'm wrong, I would wish to be corrected by my attention to be directed to the actual act, to the actual article which creates such obligation, because I think that's important to understand how much discretion we have as legislatures. That's my first question. My second question is, I'm afraid I did not retain your name. Kabir. Madam Chairman, can we be on a first name basis here, or? Kabir.
Well, we've been working on family names.
Oh, okay, thank you. Okay, then.
You can call me Babikate. B-A-V-I-K.
Is Kabir your first name? Babikate. Okay, apologies. The issue of the self-identification drawn from the community to the knowledge. In international law, a community is the self which identifies itself as such. We are a community. We say we are self, we are a community. And that's acceptable. And I don't have a problem with that. But when it goes to the knowledge which is carried over, this is our knowledge. Again, the self-claim of knowledge is problematic, especially because it's public knowledge. I always make my references to Zulu culture because I'm the one with which I'm most familiar, but one could make a legitimate claim that the dome in a Zulu hat, the dome in a Zulu hat is part of their knowledge. Actually, was it can be traced to 6,000 years to the Persians. So, but they could legitimately say it is our knowledge, because we are the first people who intricated things in a certain way and made a touch dome, and it would be legitimate. Which leads to the next point. I mean, it's the same point, but patents do not give rights. Patents merely give a presumption. The patent only gives you a favorable owner of proof. So much so in South Africa. I can have in South Africa, because there is no examination, a patent on the light bulb and the bicycle. No, it's a fact, and it's not an hyperbole. Well, no, because if it would need to wait 2 years, the situation CIPRO is in now. So, now, the registration, it is not clear whether it purports to give a right or again just a favorable onus, a favorable presumption in case of litigation. But how does one deal with the state now becoming the recipient of an infringement action? And what are the financial implications of the state having to register everything? Because people will claim everything, most of which, as it happens in patents, are not legitimate, and then having to defend all this through the process. And that leads me to my third question. The entire issue of knowledge, use, and public domain. Here we are in the difficult business, depending on the metaphor you prefer, of putting the genie back into the bottle or unscramble the egg. The knowledge is public. It's in the public domain. If you weren't, there is secrecy, and it could be dealt under existing legislation as a secret, and the patent is collectively because the community is an entity and could do it. The only reason why we're dealing with this is because it is public knowledge. Now, if it is public knowledge in an environment in which no community has asserted the knowledge, because it's not the environment, they don't share knowledge with agreements, we are going to have, in all likelihood, situations in which one community claims the protection of the knowledge, while the other doesn't. There are certain practices in, again, Zulu culture in healing things, which I found in the Italian community. They are traditional. And at the end, what is traditional is traditional. It comes out of the experience of being people, humans. It's knowledge. So if the Zulu community intends to protect it as its own, and rightly so, how would that affect the Italian community to continue to use what it is their traditional knowledge, openly non-protected, and without having to go through the burden of satisfying itself having to show that it was their own? That's on the one hand. And then on the point of exploitment, the one who exploits it, because some it's in the public knowledge protected and some is the public knowledge unprotected, can say that he got the remedies not from the Zulus but from the Italians. So we are creating a catching of protection, which is really a sieve. At the end, everything will go through one loophole or the other. I will stop at this, but I have another 2,000 questions.
Mr. Ariaya, you need to join us for lunch. Ambrosini.
How could I possibly refuse?
Although we don't have wine, I regret that. Because I know how well a meal does go down with a little Chianti or something. Mr. Maria.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Two issues that I want to raise in response to the presentation, which was excellent in my opinion. The one is about the ownership, and that you have said that the you know, the assumption from the current legislation or proposal of the bill is that the ownership of the will be in the state. Now, surely if a community right comes from over ages and over time, surely that community's perception will be that they are the owners of those intellectual properties and not the state. And clearly there must be then a enormous consultation with communities to make sure that they are aware and concede that they are going to lose ownership from the community to the state. Because I foresee that as a huge conflict. Because a benefit is one thing, but a benefit can only derive from something that you own. And I think if it is about traditional knowledge, surely that, that, that implies that, that that is owned by a community. And don't you foresee that that will be a major problem and even something for litigation that, that is lying ahead? So that is quite clearly, in my opinion, a huge stumbling block in any implementation of an, a related act like this. The other one is in terms of communities. You've talked about communities, and sometimes I get the feeling that it is obviously a very simplified way that you've put it, you know, of identifying a community. You know, it's kind of we decided we're a community. But what you find in a country like South Africa is that we've got so many communities, and what has happened, migration from one community to the other, in terms of marriages, in terms of children. How do you foresee that one must deal with that? Because suddenly, you know, to put it very simple, if there's a community in the Northern Cape that says that we're the Sun community or the Khoi community, and, you know, we own certain things, but now some of our people has been migrated either to the Eastern Cape or to the Western Cape and has been migrated into either with Khoisas or with Afrikaners or white people. What happens to that community now? Is it only those that still in that geographical area, as you've put it, that will sometimes just die out and there will be nobody left? Or is it this extended community that should now be benefiting? Because the moment that you look at an extended community, where do you stop? And where do you start? And how do you determine then? Because, I mean, what happens if some people say, no, I don't see you as part of this community. Sorry, you know, your skin is too dark or too bleak or too whatever. You know, you don't fit in with our idea of our visions in terms of our community. How do you deal with that? That, in my mind, is some of the essence, because if you don't cross certain Rubicons and deal with certain issues, you can have all these talks in whatever you want to, and eventually you will get nowhere if the people don't take ownership of what is happening here. Thank you.
I have two myself. The one goes back, I think, to Dr. Braun, von Braun, and that concerns the biodiversity I referred to yesterday again. Fine, you know, one seemed to get some better idea today. But I'm looking at a situation where the community here does, in fact, sell the plant, whatever it is, quite legitimately, as it were, either the community or group or government or whatever. And it's sold to the United States or Britain, Europe, India, etc. Now, while it is there, it is then unpacked scientifically, and the chemical DNA is all put on paper, and pharmaceutical companies or various other organizations may then be able to discover and identify some of the properties therein
which could replace some of the synthetic medication that they have been producing. I hope I've made myself clear. On the other hand, no sooner does it come out, and just as an example, this will cure heart disease or whatever, then the community who's even sold this or been part of it said, but we sold you the plants as a, you know, put on your windowsill or something, you know, as a plant. We already know that. We're already using it for that. We're already using it. Can this be legislated for? I think we are attempting to try and legislate this. And what is your view in that particular regard? Because on the one hand, the department tells us, well, nothing can be retrospective, you know. So it means that we've already lost so much, you see. It's not retrospective, the current legislation, in this regard. When it comes to yourself, Mr. Bobbycat, you spoke about a common pool and how this could be utilized. I think it was once something was in a public domain and then taken back to the community, if you like, and how it could be brought out. You can't, once it's in the public domain, keep it only for your community. I just want to clarify what it is I heard. You do have to make it available, if you like, to others. I'm thinking of performers, music, dance, that kind of thing. Was in the public domain. Now you say, no, but you don't. Now we have the opportunity. This is ours. We can prove it. We want it back. Are they then expected to allow this on the CD, allow this on there, without any right to either remuneration or at least some moral right to say how it should be sung or whatever, you know? So I just want a clarification in that regard. Now, I realize, Mr. Lateef, you've got a number of questions in this regard. And yes, I was thinking we could just extend things by half an hour, not 12, but half past 12. But we would appreciate a comprehensive response.
Thank you. Indeed, that is quite a comprehensive set of questions and extremely challenging. Some of them have some common elements about the identification of communities and related issues. So maybe would you like to start, Kabir, and then Joanna, and maybe Graham would like to call, or Olivia would like to come on some of them.
Thank you for your questions. I mean, extremely comprehensive and very, very acute. And I noticed a certain pattern in some of the questions. I mean, so I'm going to kind of cluster some of these questions together. there have been questions about how can the state make certain claims over knowledge that is developed and owned by certain communities? I mean, what is the right of the state to make these kind of claims? There have been questions about how would this affect the rights of other communities that, in one sense, also share this particular knowledge. So you have a situation where the bill provides for the fact that if the community that has developed this particular traditional knowledge is always entitled to use this knowledge. And so in one sense, that community doesn't have to pay any royalties because it is their knowledge. Well, if others would like to use it commercially, well, that's where the problem comes in. But what about others saying that, well, you know, we may not have been used, we may not at some level have been the progenitors of this knowledge, but we've been using it for a number of years. And so what about the rights of these other communities? And there was an issue of the need for extensive consultation with the community before an activity like this takes place, where the state asserts certain ownership rights. And and of course, how do you deal with the challenge of identifying who a community is, and the fact of mixing between communities, and what one is talking about is not a, is a continuum rather than kind of, you know, segmented groups of people. And I mean, this is always going to be an open-ended question. I mean, people have debated this for years, and at some level, definitions of communities are always open-ended definitions with a list of things, saying that these things could be indicators of what a community is, and a community is never static, it's dynamic, it's always becoming, it has never become, in one sense. So so these, in one sense, are one group of questions, and of course this is linked to the question on, therefore, what kind of model should be used, and what kind of model would be appropriate in a situation like this. I think when questions are so fundamental, I think one must go down to kind of first principles, or go down to the fundamental issues itself. Why are we having this particular discussion? Why did this come about now? I mean, why haven't we had this before? Why is this sudden kind of push towards protection of traditional knowledge? And therein comes this issue of why are communities asserting rights of ownership over knowledge? Where did this all come from? And I'm sure Graham can would probably speak more about this. But in both national processes in other countries and in South Africa, and especially in also international processes, there have been two reasons why there has been this kind of a push by communities. On the one hand, this has been, again, as I said, it has been defensive because of certain models of intellectual property rights protection. What you have is this kind of mining of the common pool. So you have things being taken out of the common pool, things which were always, in one sense, freely shared. I mean, freely shared, but with certain conditions of how they must be used. I mean, there were always customary laws and norms about how knowledge should be used, what you can do with it, what you can't do with it, how to respect it, these kind of things. But at some level, there was a system of sharing and exchanges. But here you have this particular kind of system at the level of the community being confronted with another system where you have kind of clear rights of appropriation being recognized. So you have something that is being taken out of the common pool. There are kind of developments or changes made on this knowledge. And then you've got clear rights that certain individuals or companies can hold on this. So suddenly you've got two systems or two value systems confronting each other. And in one sense, there is this kind of a defensive impetus by communities who are saying that, well, now, in the name of common heritage of humankind, a lot of things have been kind of taken out of this common and appropriated. Well, let's change the terms of that debate now. This is no longer common heritage of humankind. These are owned by specific communities, and we will set the terms for use. If you take it, you will not be allowed to appropriate it. So in one sense, there is that sense of a defensive kind of a push. It is in one sense a reaction. On the other hand, there is also this reaction by communities in a number of situations, even where in the context of certain kind of excesses by the state, where it is a way for communities to assert certain rights, to be able to say that these are our ways of life. And in one sense, it is a part of the larger discourse of kind of self-determination. And by self-determination, I don't essentially mean a separate statehood, but a self-determination saying a degree of autonomy about how we make decisions about things that concern us. And at some level, these rights of decision-making shouldn't be taken away from us. Now, a lot of these challenges now that are coming in about, let's identify a particular community that owns this knowledge, and therefore then that community would have specific rights, as opposed to other communities that may also have new rights. These are clear challenges, because in a number of situations, these have led to certain frictions between communities. For example, clearly with the Hoodia case, there were frictions between the San and the Nama community on the access and benefit sharing agreement. And at the same time, there has been this big challenge of, therefore, how do you recognize rights, and at the same time ensure that we don't create a system that is virtually unmanageable, which raises these kind of questions: who are owners, who have the right to negotiate, what rights does the state have to step in on behalf of communities, what kind of consultations must take place, what are the rights of other communities to use this particular system. So in one sense, I feel that a lot of these questions have come in because of conflicting models of what does ownership mean, or what does custodianship mean, where one model of ownership talks about certain absolute rights to exclude, whereas another model of custodianship says that, well, we want to preserve certain value systems of sharing and exchange, and we don't want that affected, and therefore we will apply certain kinds of defensive protection. And this leads us to the models, some of the models that I propose as possible models that exist now. The idea, in one sense, of a community commons model, the organization I work with, Natural Justice, has been for a long time working on a particular model called the traditional knowledge commons, which is essentially a model that seeks to kind of deal with something like this. And in one sense, you want a model that ensures that the integrity of the commons is maintained. Things are not appropriated out of the commons. And at the same time, that the commons doesn't become a euphemism for people can do whatever they want and use this particular knowledge however they want without respecting certain customary rules and norms in terms of how this particular knowledge should be used. So it has to be a delicate balance of keeping a common pool on the same values that the community has traditionally kept this particular common pool, saying that this common pool doesn't necessarily have to be only at the level of the community. It can be an expanding commons as long as other entrants to this commons are willing to abide by the rules of this particular commons. And these are traditional rules that have always been set by communities in terms of sharing and exchange. And at the same time, certain rights have to be respected. And there were always customary norms or laws or even traditions of how knowledge can be used, what is sacred, what cannot be used, what should be used in a certain way. And in one sense, the idea of the fourth model, when you're talking about a certain kind of a traditional knowledge commons, is essentially that, where it's not so much an idea of trying to kind of say that the state owns the copyright over this, or it's not so much an issue of trying to generate certain kinds of royalties, or it's not that the state that you have the state kind of taking over. But one could well create this kind of a model where you say that it is a defensive protection. We are trying to assert that these things are a part of the common pool. You could also have a cross-section of community representatives. We could have extensive consultations on what are the core values of this kind of a traditional commons. And if the core values are, you know, free exchange, if the core values are share alike, if the core values are respect to certain kind of cultural ways of kind of using this knowledge, then these can be the laws of this particular commons. So we can say that if anyone wants to use this, say for example, there is a... If anyone...
You see, I also, if I'm not mistaken, you and Dr. Van Dorn are based here.
Yes.
So I'm sure we're going to be calling you back.
Yes.
Whereas we won't have that same opportunity with the others. And time is certainly not very friendly.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just finish in the next minute. So the idea would be that if one would seek to use from this commons, whatever you develop would have to be put back into the commons, because that is the value of the commons, that what you take from the pool, you would have to put back into the pool, whatever development you have, because you have benefited from it. So this can be a model that can be explored. And And I would stop there, and of course, your question about what are the provisions of the Convention on Biological Diversity and the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, I can kind of discuss with you at the end of this meeting. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just quickly to respond to your question. The key difference between sending a plant abroad and then the issue about when somebody starts getting into engaging in research is basically the use. What do you use the plant for, particularly? So one is just sending the plant abroad, but as you start utilizing the plant, then you would trigger, if you want, the bioprospecting framework. Now, the question of whether it's taking place abroad, whether that makes a difference, is in the South African legislation, the definition of indigenous biological resource is a country of origin definition, where it says any plant that historically has been from South Africa would then trigger this particular framework, and it doesn't matter where the plant is located. Now, to what extent that can be implemented is, of course, another question. You know, how long is the arm of South African law? Can we go, and that was the issue in the Nestle case, can we go to Switzerland to take Nestle to court for something that they're doing in Switzerland in a research laboratory? For that particular purpose, the discussions on the international regime on access and benefit sharing are crucial, because what they try to do is to set a mechanism where you precisely can do that. Another thing is, of course, whether you could take affiliates in South Africa to court here, but that obviously also needs a certain political will to go against such, you know, actors, if you want. But the possibility is there, but it hasn't been done yet in South Africa. But basically, so in that case, the key trigger is what is the use of the resource, rather than, you know, who sends it and where.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Joanna, just on the question of example of non-commercial benefits, because I think there was a specific question on non-commercial benefits.
Yeah, it's obviously a difficult question, which is coming up a lot. Is there such thing as non-commercial research, really? I mean, also, if you have a big university grant into basic research, essentially there is a commercial aspect to it with respect to whoever is doing the research. They're making some money, maybe publishing, there's a publication. Is that, you know, what do you count as non-commercial research? Again, it's a difficult question. The way the bioprospecting framework deals with it is it defines what means the entry into a commercialization phase, and there's certain trigger points. One is the application for a patent, or the reproduction on a larger scale of something, or there are a number of trigger points in which they try to not so much say, you know, you define commercial or non-commercial by whoever is doing the research, but at what the stage of the research, rather. Are you in the very beginning of a research project, and maybe it always remains as a discovery phase, and then it would not enter into the commercial, if you want, commercial resource folder. Or if you are starting with a discovery phase research, which then becomes interesting for commercial research, then you would then trigger the framework, if you want. I personally can't think of a better way than of doing it than that, because institutionally it would be very difficult to differentiate what's commercial, what's non-commercial, and there's a lot of early research, even by commercial interest, which never really goes anywhere and essentially also doesn't necessarily need to trigger the application of the framework. But I think that you will not find a very clear-cut differentiation. You can just get as close as you can in order to have certain trigger points.
John, I think the question was about the benefits to the community.
Yes.
Now, the benefits to the community can be monetary and non-monetary benefits.
Okay.
I think the
question was, what are non-monetary benefits to the community? Yes. They differentiate what is listed. They could be from infrastructure to research to joint like infrastructure support. There could be acknowledgement, which is a huge thing for many communities, saying at least, you know, even if there's no particular large commercial benefits, that we want to be acknowledged for the knowledge that we have. Another thing is integration into joint research, maybe to training. Sometimes it's to give feedback on the
maybe more information on the particular plants and questions. It could be conservation effort. It could be pretty much anything they would like to have. So the what the bioprospecting firm does is list, but it gives a spaces for alternative options that the community would like to see in this.
Unfortunately, I'm not taking any more questions. We do have people who will come back from Cape Town. Time is running against us. It's 10:45, and we need to just get through it all. I need to find out from members here if the questions were answered, Mr. Maria.
Yeah, it was dealt with, probably not, you know, all the answers.
But they are here. Yeah. Right. Mr. Njikalana.
Unless the answer was amongst the lost or lost in the way, I was provoking what I regarded as a fifth model, and I wanted to check whether it is a fifth model or it's found in the four models, where I was saying that the state doesn't actually take the benefits of the money and keep, but it serves as a conduit to ensure appropriate and equitable sharing. Yeah, even where there are these dynamics and tensions, maybe various communities claiming, then the state becomes the facilitator there.
And Mr. Ariani Ambrosini, I think some of your questions weren't, but I'm hoping that if they were directed at the two at the end, they're both here in Cape Town.
See, no, my question weren't, obviously, I do have a sense of what the answer is. I don't ask questions unless I have the answer. But because it's important. I mean, we are in the process of deliberating, so things are placed on record for common understanding, and then we can proceed on that basis. But I think, Madam Chair, that your own question perhaps was not fully answered, and I think yours was a very critical question. My reading of the situation.
Yeah, if I may interrupt you. I realize that, but I will be calling both of these experts back at some point just to see whether they could spend some time with us in formal committee. And I do hope you will avail yourself for a couple of hours in that regard. Will you be able to do that? Because I'd like us to move on then with Mr. Lateef. I see Professor Dutcliffe, probably not Dutcliffe, sorry, Dutfield. Yes.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll give the floor now to Professor Dutfield, who's free to comment actually on the preceding conversation. I don't know if you want to say something on that, but then he will address an issue that was raised yesterday in the beginning of our meeting about, and it relates directly to the draft bill in front of us, about the pros and cons of a protection for traditional knowledge and traditional culture expressions through the IP system or through a sui generis system. Right, that's a very fundamental question that you raised yesterday, and Professor Graham will elaborate on that and mentioning some examples of what has been done in this regard, and then we will a bit with Olivier have a bit of a look into the draft bill itself and just look at some examples and comments on a number of things in the draft bill, just for sharing reflections and sharing thoughts with you about our comments in this regard.
Thank you. I'd also like to respond briefly to the query concerning the Zulu Dome, and you were saying about the health knowledge, some of that you could say is derived from of Italian knowledge, or it has a similarity with. Is that more or less right? Okay. Or did I get it wrong? Because what I wanted to respond to is about that particular view.
Well, my question was starting from the premises that, given by the presenter, that it is our knowledge because I say so. So the self-assertion of knowledge. I have no problem with a community saying we are a community because I say so.
Right.
But a community saying I've invented the dome, because my great-grandfathers invented it, which is correct in this context, and I say so. It's a correct statement within the parameters of that community, but when taken out, one gives the perspective that the dome was invented by the Persians 6,000 years earlier.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Well, thinking about IP law, intellectual property law, is that it's about abstractions, and so we have to accept very questionable sort of categories, such as, you know, the inventor, now or the author. I mean, everything that we know, no matter how creative we may be, is based on the state of the art, plus maybe a slight change or a slight improvement. You know, aspirin, right? Aspirin has been known about, you know, the active, you know, the extract of willow bark. It's been known about and used as a painkiller for 7,000 years, but patented by Bayer in 1899, right? And you can say, well, how could that possibly be? And yet, according to patent law, categories, it is something new, right? We now accept that a microorganism, it can be an invention. A bit of DNA is an invention, right, for the purposes of patent law. And why has that happened? Why that happened is not purely because, you know, courts trying to be objective. The law evolves largely for political reasons, right? So we accept these questionable categories as real ones. And why is that? Largely because professional lawyers who make money out of the system have managed to convince policymakers, right, that these categories are real ones, right? Now, so I could say, well, so I completely accept what your view. I completely accept that a lot of knowledge, cultural expressions are shared among certain groups. I completely accept that. And anyway, that's why I'm a little bit concerned about going down the IP route, is that these are very sort of difficult. And, you know, if these questionable categories and boundaries work for our purposes, right, and if their adoption doesn't create conflicts, then maybe it's worth trying. But, you know, I do worry a little bit, you know, and I do share some of your sort of concerns. You know, is this an IP issue, or is it something that should be dealt with in a completely sort of different way? That doesn't necessarily involve ownership or possession, it's rather charged terms, but legitimate interests. I mean, a lot of this discussion, I mean, when I was got involved in this, I'll be brief, I got involved in this a long time ago. I mean, my sort of mentor in the subject was an anthropologist who lived in the Amazon, right? In the Amazon, where the local knowledge is quite distinct and is different from the cultural mainstream, and therefore it tends to be sort of disparaged and looked down on. And there was a strong movement to say, you know, this is worthy of respect, of recognition, of reward, where it is being used by others. And that's a much more of a black and white clear-cut issue. But we get into very complex areas, and, you know, law has to be written with a great deal of care. And I think you do need to involve, the beneficiaries have to be involved in the whole process, but also, you also need professionals who are also able to see the pitfalls, who are able to say, look, you know, this isn't going to work in practice because, and I'm not a lawyer myself, although I'm a law professor, that's a long story, it's been one in our show, it's been easy to, and lawyers are very helpful people, but they also can be a pain, but they're very, very helpful people. And IP systems work, they work because of professional people, right? Okay, sometimes they're very self-serving, right? But you need professional people. If you provide some sort of protection system for people who don't know how to use it or are not aware of it, it's a complete waste of time. Again, I'm moving away a little bit from your query, but, you know, if you go down the IP road,
it does give rise to perfectly reasonable concerns that, you know, who owns what are their rights. But, you know, people have interest in their cultural expression, and that is something the law, I think, should support. One has to be careful about, let's say, I'm going to say this, over-claiming things that are not yours, or not only yours. So, it won't be.
Hey, Graham, do you want to go into the IP sui generis?
I'll do that later.
Uh-huh.
Well, I could.
Yeah. And then we go to the booth.
That's what we lead on, in a way, too. What
now? Yeah.
What would mean the whole thing?
Oh, okay. Okay, well, I can do that. Okay. Okay.
Well, see, I've just been asked to talk about slightly longer presentation now than I've just said. Now, in terms, in terms of the choice being IP or something completely different, I guess I've slightly left on where my particular point of view on this. Now, usually in the evolution of IP law, it obviously has changed a lot in the last 100 years or so. And when one is faced with a different kind of subject matter, right, one has two choices. You know, you can either, by analogy, squeeze it into the law you already have, right? So, when it comes to biotechnology, as I mentioned, we treat, well, certainly in Europe, North America, we've gone from purified natural compounds, natural chemicals, we treat those as inventions if we make those available to the public in a particular way for the first time. Is that a bit bogus? Is that a bit fictional? Is that sleight of hand? Perhaps it is. But that has opened the door to DNA, to microorganisms, to plants, and animals. All right? Some things simply don't fit, or for political reasons, decisions have been made not to fit them in. So what do? We create a new fission-error system. So, you know, plant varieties are very difficult to describe as inventions. Apparently, we say plant varieties, well, why not if they're animals? But a decision was made in Europe, right, that we would keep plant varieties, plant breeding, out of the patent system, right? And so we created a new system, the UPOV system, which has is a subject of a convention. Now, so we keep that out of existing IP. We create a new IP right for that. The mask works of semiconductor chips, electric ions, medical circuits. We created a new IP right just for that. Right. But how do we design an alternative system? Usually, these are what you could call hybrid systems. Right, we take little bits here and there, we mix it together, and we come up with something new. Right. The question then arises with traditional knowledge and traditional cultural expressions, right, is to what extent, if you do go down the sui generis road, if you decided the conventional IP categories just don't really fit. Right. Now, I know the bill that I've seen basically sort of tinkers a little bit the existing IP system, all right, okay, but that is not really
That's not what I'm saying. A hybrid system, it would be something that takes some of the provisions of existing IP rights, you put it together. So plant variety protection is a little bit like copyright, a little bit patent, but it is something really quite different. Now, what do we do with traditional knowledge and traditional cultural expressions, right? Now, by using those terms, we have already made an implicit sort of decision, right? Anyway, because we talk about traditional knowledge usually in a context of patents. We talk about traditional cultural expression, or folklore as it used to be called. We seem to stop calling it folklore. Is implicitly in a domain of copyright. Of course, these categories are imposed categories. So, you know, indigenous, traditional, local communities, and those are also both categories. These are categories that, you know, sort of middle-aged men in ties have dreamed up, you know, and we think, you know, so we've already shifted the whole discussion in a way that suits us, right? So then we can say we're the experts, tell you what it will be. Which can be very embarrassing in a way if we have any sense of irony. And unfortunately, I have an over elaborate sense of irony, which sometimes gets me in trouble. And I'll try and keep it in check before I get asked to leave the room. Okay. So we've already made a split. A split which doesn't make any sense to a lot of whether we talk about, you know, Amazon Indians or you know, just people whose lifestyles are quite distinct from the urban reasonably wealthy. Turn, push a button, the lights come on. Push a button, the toilet flushes, etc. You know, the life that we all live here, right? It is completely different. The way of thinking is totally different, completely, utterly, profoundly different. In a sense, these, whatever law we come up with, is a kind of imposition, right? Now, all societies of the world are, or should be, to some degree pragmatic, all right? And we accept some of the things that are imposed on us if they suit us, right? And why not? You know, that's a big thing. And we adapt it to our own ends. So it's not inherently a bad thing, and so something could come out of it. After this very, alien way of coming up with these sort of aliens to the people who are supposed to benefit from the system. Okay, now, so what we need to do. Right, we, and I say everyone, needs to do it, is to define the problem. What is the problem that needs to be solved? Now, we may have our own ideas, certainly I have my own ideas, but at the end of the day, the only people who can define the problem are the people who are supposed to benefit from it. Right? And politicians alone, academics alone, are the wrong people to do that. They can't do it by themselves. Obviously, they have an incredibly important role to play, but they just can't do it by themselves. And if I could say something rather strong, you know, drafting a new law without.
All on one side and DTI to sit all on the other side. Just to start, where are you?
Here.
Now, I think just to fix your muscles a bit, take a couple of snaps, you know, the committee will be on that side, the experts on this side, and then you'll set us up where we can. You know, all these. Okay. Huh? Yeah, well, whatever. But right now, you're going to just take a couple of snacks. And then we, you know, we'll be at your location. All right. So does everyone understand that?
I expected you to move a lot faster. You don't have crutches.
I think I was proposing, Madam Chairman.
Okay. No, now next thing they'll say, she's even got the eye of kneeling in a
band. I would defend myself by saying I would say what I was proposing.
Yes, well, there we are. Next thing you'll have my husband at your door.
My wife.
There we go.
It is back to us.
Okay, thank you. Okay, can I just finish off what I was saying?
About the Ariani Ambrosini.
Okay.
We were carrying on.
Okay, thank you. If we wanted to change patent law, who would we talk to? We would bring in inventors, the businesses, the patent lawyers, the patent agents. And why? It's because they are the users of the system. They're the ones who actually, who interpret the system. So they're the beneficiaries, but they're also the users. They're the ones that actually put it into effect. So, by the same principle, surely legislation on cultural expression, social knowledge, whatever term you end up choosing to use, can only be drawn up appropriately if you have if you're willing to go through a period of discussion at a local level, consultation with groups at local level all around the country, right? And obviously not only them, right, but also you need to have some kind of, if we have a patent community, which is by the lawyers, businesses, youth, etc., you need to have a TK or a TCE sort of community, which comprises not only the local communities, indigenous groups, but also those who will be involved in making the system work. If you're going to claim rights, you're going to enforce your rights, who do you need to go to? You can't do it yourself. You need to go to lawyers, basically. Unfortunately, lawyers are kind of essential to make something work. So they also have to be part, because they're the ones who are going to first see the practical problems as they arrive. It's got to be learning by doing. If you come up with a completely new law, you can't be guaranteed how it's going to work the way you want it to work. You have to make sure they're able to review it periodically. And those with the most direct experience are the ones who are going to tell you what needs to be changed, what needs to be reformed, revised, how you tweak the system as you go along. And that requires time and effort. Obviously, it also requires money as well. It costs money to have all these meetings and things. Two other countries that I do know have these regional systems. There's Panama. And also Peru. The Peruvian process I know a little bit about, because it did involve a long process a bit like that. They went all around Peru talking with community groups, etc. They were criticized there because then suddenly the law was finished and passed rather hurriedly. It was in the main quite positive for a process. Because users of IT systems have a sense of ownership, I think, of the system. Right. So the communities who want to benefit have to have a sense of ownership, and that cannot be done really with a paternalistic sort of top-down way of doing law here. And what problems do they have that they want law to solve? It's not necessarily for us to actually say that in any sort of definitive way. We have our own ideas. Is it misappropriation? Is it a problem of missed opportunities of making an income out of their cultural expression, etc.? Is that the problem? Because how you just define the problem is how you design the solution. So I think I'll sort of stop there. I could say something about the bill, about definitions, formalities, issues of registration, the database, all those various cans of worms. But rather than myself, I think I shall hand over
to our next speaker.
So, Madam Chair, thank you very much, Graham. We'll get into the.
You can go on for a few more. I'm waiting for the committee to speak.
Okay, so we
put it in up here.
So we'll go into the issue of more precisely the some of the matters raised in the bill. Just I think commenting the legislative process as described by Graham is very interesting, because the communities are involved, the consultations with the communities and the holders of traditional knowledge and traditional expressions are important. Another element is that in many cases now, in these kinds of laws, because we're dealing with new issues and there's a lot of uncertainty, right? What is done is that there are embedded review mechanisms in the law, right? So the law says that within 5 years, let's say, of implementation, there will be a complete assessment of how it is being implemented, and you know, an analysis of its implications. Is it working? Is it not working or not? And that's a way also to protect or to say like we want also to see how this works in practice. You know, we're not just gonna create a set of laws for eternity, and you know, we're also gonna see how it works in practice and adapt it, adjust it, or change it according to how it works. But in any case, I mean, you're better to place it. I mean, lawmaking is not an easy matter, and I think the consultation process mentioned by Graham is quite important. So I give the floor now to our next speaker, who is gonna. Maybe also with Graham intervening also at the same time, pinpoint to some of the, have a closer look at the amendment law and to see some of the issues relating to definitions and to the system put in place that we're going to look at.
Can I possibly ask the professor just a question? You have alluded to too generous process and quite a number of times, but also per implication.
Yeah.
And I know that has been a subject of discussion and debate in South Africa as well, and when we were in Geneva as well, you know, what is the best way of how to deal with these issues? Now, I know you've said that you've got your own views, but that's your own academic views.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if we listen to what has been said, then it's certainly going to be a drawn-out process.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the different IP pieces of legislation have an impact on that. What is your view on sui generis as an alternative of maybe quicker and more focused dealing with the challenges and getting something on the table to effectively deal with these questions?
Thank you for the question. That's not an easy question. You're too kind. Yeah.
Really being asked is your opinion.
Yeah. Okay, my opinion.
Yes.
Like
talking to lawyers.
Yeah.
The reason why we have so many lawyers is because we all have different opinions.
Yeah. I have to say.
You go ahead.
Well, I've been on quite a long road because I was interested in subjects in 1993, and I sat with some embarrassment because actually I end up thinking this is very confusing and difficult. You know? I do think that first, you know, the IP route will not solve it, but you can at least deal with abuses, perhaps by tightening up the system in certain ways. A sui generis system, I've sort of long been a sort of advocate of a sui generis system, but that carries a heavy responsibility on my part, not to promote a sort of dumb ideas that just aren't going to work. I do think that local people have their own norms about access to their knowledge, their cultural expressions, and I think that's where any design issues have to actually start. Right. At the same time, it may well end up that there is no sort of conceivable national. There's no way to define those norms, right, in terms of a national law, right. It may be the process will not get anywhere. Let's say, right. It may be that no sui generis system that we could come up would be consistent with our constitution, with our without a long evolution of our national laws, it may actually just not be able to come up with anything that's actually going to work. So, I mean, I think you have to, it's better to have no law than a bad law.
but it has to be a law. I mean, okay, it has to be consistent with local norms about access and use, I think, right, as a minimum requirement. That is a necessary but not sufficient condition, let's say, right? And to the extent those norms may be more or less shared by different groups within this country, right, then you have something to go on. When norms are not shared by different groups, then I don't think a national law is going to work at all. Okay. That's a... that's helpful or totally unhelpful, but you asked my view, and that's, I'm afraid it came out that way.
I just want to check with Mr. Lindsay, what else have we got on the program, seeing as we changed quite a bit yesterday? I thought that Professor Duckfield was going to come in with perhaps a half an hour or something, or how is it going to work?
Professor Duffield is with us, and the presentation he made on the IPN sui generis system was the bulk of his intervention, but he's free also to intervene in the coming period about the bill itself. So what we have left in our program,
yes,
is a closer look at the amendment bill.
So is that what we're going to look at with Mr. Rakunda?
Yes. And Professor Graham will also be intervening in that.
Of course.
Okay.
The reason I mention that is because, in a way, we're looking at about an hour next. So that's why, we need to manage the time, because the President is responding to questions at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
And it won't be possible for us to have lunch beyond 1:45.
Okay.
I hope I'm clear.
We'll be done before that, yeah.
Okay, over to you. So, as long as you're aware of that. And may I add, members of the committee, I have a bank of questions to ask. And I will take the opportunity of, through our secretary, just one photograph. We don't want to create the impression we don't have a committee secretary, so just down from the bottom. After all, him and the content specialists are very hard working, do bulk of the work while we talk.
Okay.
Another thing would be, you could join us at lunch, and then we go outside because we are being paid sweet. Is that a problem?
No.
Okay, if it is, we're going to go now to six. No. We need now just for 3 minutes to go and take the photograph. And apparently, you found some sticks. All right. We have got to get outside in 2 minutes. Now, some of you are able to run. So, you've got some of you who can run will take the lift last. And those, like Peter and myself, who belong to the elite club, will have to go in the first lift. And Mr. Lerman will be guiding us. There are 3 lifts in this building. And let's move out, try and get downstairs in 2 minutes, take the photograph in 2 minutes, and get up in 2 minutes. Let's move. Now.
Thank you.
a list of telephones.
Finite in time, that it does. Usually terms of protection which again, depending on national legislation, can range from 50 to 70 years in terms of protection that's granted. So the question that arises here is, are we seeking for a protection of traditional knowledge, traditional cultural expression, which is finite in time, or which is not finite in time, which takes into account future generations and the need to protect this traditional knowledge and cultural expressions over an indefinite amount of time? Which, those are questions that I think are worth contemplating, particularly when you were looking at sort of the usefulness of copyright in terms of protecting traditional knowledge and cultural expressions. Furthermore, in terms of the copyright itself, from a purely legal point of view, when the protection is sort of ended, the work that is the object of the protection usually enters the public domain. So this is another sort of element to consider. Within the bill, there is this idea of collective certification that is introduced in Article 19. And basically, it uses, again, sort of concepts of intellectual property law that we sort of to speak squarely of intellectual property with regard to trademarks, this idea of collective trademark, sort of to see how trademark could also act as a protection of traditional cultural expressions.
Just a minute, which bill are you referring to when you say in the bill?
Okay, I'm referring to sort of the intellectual property laws bill, the amendment suggestion. So
this is the one that says amendment of section 9.
Right.
Act 194.
That's right. So it's the amendment to the Trademarks Act that I'm referring to.
Oh, the other
bill. Yes.
I mean, what can be improved at that part is such an the trademark bill is actually referring to, which is incorporated in this amendment.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, if that can just be clear.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, with regards to, again, I'm going to pass quickly on this concept because I think we need a broader discussion with regards to the discussion that we started with Professor Graham as to this distinction between IP and sui generis system. Again, in the bill, there's the issue of collective trademarks that are sort of drawn upon in terms of the protection, traditional cultural expression, and traditional knowledge. And I think a fundamental question also here is that in order for this type of protection in terms of traditional knowledge and traditional cultural expression to be useful, it will require that communities form an association or be represented in a way that they could advocate for their interests and sort of be able to make use of this type of protection. And I think there's been quite a bit of discussion here from members who have actually informed us that in the context of South Africa, for example, there's so many communities, there's so many knowledge that's shared that it's often difficult to sort of pinpoint the knowledge to one specific community, one specific entity. So this might be some of the problems that may arise with regard to using these traditional means of protection. There's also issues of geographic indication that's also reflected. And also, this type of protection in terms of law is usually limited in that, in the broad sense, geographic indication refers to the indication of source, appellation of origin, and geographic indication in the broader sense. Now, again, the question is to ask, is this type of protection that's really narrow in form of the law adequate to protect knowledge that's often sort of transboundary, as we spoke about cultural expressions that are shared between communities that just transcend geographical jurisdiction and communities. Again, the question just to pose is this, would this be appropriate with regard to fostering the adequate protection that we're seeking? And then I'm going to pass quickly on this because I think my colleague Kabir talked about this. With regard to the creation of database, I think, again, the question is, we have experiences of the databases that have been created to protect traditional knowledge in India and in other countries. And I think Kabir today just went through some of the issues that have arisen with regards to the use of databases for the protection of traditional knowledge and cultural expressions. So with your permission, what I would now suggest is that we basically go back to the debate that we started with Professor Graham and ask him also if he has some interventions to make with regards to the discussion that we started with regards to the distinction between IP and pseudogenericism.
Okay, thank you. Just to sort of clarify about the distinction, I talked about hybrid systems and the degrees of hybridity, right? If it's very high, very, if it is based on existing IP rules rearranged and mixed around, that's not going to be very different. But most people think of a pseudogenic system as actually being very different, not at all using the language of IP. And I tried to say yesterday about, IP is meant to provide, it's meant primarily to benefit society as a whole. You give rights to both individuals, or companies usually. The idea is by doing that, the society does benefit. And that explains a lot about how we balance the rights. There are restrictions on terms. There are limitations and exceptions, and so that sort of formula, that cost-benefit calculus, is implicit in the whole design of patents, copyright, etc. Now we can discuss whether it works that well, whether the balance is right, but there is that attempt to do that. A system, when you get away from IP, the question of whether you need a balance at all becomes a rather interesting one. Right. If it is purely to benefit those communities, right, irrespective of whether society as a whole benefits. And the most fundamental questions arise, which I talk about pseudogenic systems. You get into a bit of a hole here, but I think it's a direction you ought to go and try it out. But it does lead you off the edge of a cliff in a way. Well, hopefully with a parachute, so you land safely. but it does give us some really best questions. So, you have a discussion on this, and you'd be ready to have very long discussions, which are inconclusive, but it's interesting. Maybe it's worth doing, I'm sorry, no, here I go again, the academic saying it's really complicated, Now,
it is very complex, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Right, okay, yes, true. Okay. Now, if I could just say one or two things about the geographic indications. Now, the Europeans are, particularly the Swiss and the French, are missionary about geographic indications. Right? And I can remember once a chap from the European Commission saying how wonderful geographic indications are. And I said, are you sure you really believe that, what you just said? And he said, well, that's what I'm told to say. Thanks, that's very helpful. Which is not to say geographic indications aren't a bad thing. I realise that in South Africa, you're no longer allowed to make your own port or sherry, which is kind of funny in a way, because sherry is just basically the English mispronunciation of a Spanish area. We can't say Hannes, so we say sherry because it sounds more or less accurate. In a way, Europeans are making it up as they go along, right? So, for example, Greek cheese called feta, which has been made in Germany and various countries in Europe for a long, long time, suddenly they now have to call it sort of slightly Greek-ish kind of cheese, white, wet. Cheese, they can't call it feta anymore, right? Cyprus sherry is now called Cyprus fortified wine, despite the fact Cyprus sherry is now called Cyprus fortified wine, right? So, and despite the fact that Cyprus sherry was sold in England for for decades and decades and decades. But put that to one side, perhaps, that's not to say geographic indications is a bad thing. Now, in Europe, you have three categories of geographic indication. One is indication for a product whose quality is derived from a mixture of sort of local know-how and local environment, that interaction, right? Okay. And then there's another kind of indication which is perhaps lighter in what it requires, which is that it's just basically origin place, irrespective of whether its characteristics have anything to do with the local environment. And then you have a third indication, which is about traditional things. And they don't have to be located in any particular place. So that, in short, is the European system. And as I say, we have been creative to make old things protectable. We have FETA, despite the fact it's become sort of generic. It's gone back to be ungeneric again. In England, we have cheddar cheese. You probably make cheddar cheese over here as well, I'll guess. You know, it's made everywhere. So that's gone out there. Nothing you can do about that, except you have handmade West Country cheddar cheese, which is a geographic indication. So creatively, you can find ways for old things to be protected under geographic indications. And if Europeans do it, then there's no reason why you can't do it. So I'm not a mad keen enthusiast for geographic indications, but I can see definitely a role for them. As well, it's unfortunate that European over enthusiasm for geographic indications leads one to be somewhat suspicious of the motives. But actually, geographic indications, I think, can actually definitely, even things. Well, actually, I mean things that if they're generic, supposedly you can't, but somehow, if you're creative about it, you actually still can. So there's a scope there. And these are practical marketing tools.
Graham, an example of countries that have used GI to protect traditional knowledge. Is this the case? Has it been used to protect specific traditional knowledge?
They don't protect knowledge. They protect knowledge that is embodied in goods, in products. Yeah. And although, up to now, it's mostly associated with alcoholic drinks and foods, there are attempts now to expand beyond these things. And I know India has the geographic indications law, and that they are now protecting non-food and non-drink alcoholic products. But there is a view that the indication itself can create the goodwill. Especially, trademark indications, they protect, let's say, the goodwill in the product. In other words, you establish a reputation, right? And that, and these rights enable you to protect any weakening of the reputation that you have built up. We don't yet know whether a geographical indication enables you to build up that goodwill. So in other words, these products usually apply to things that are already on the market, that are already considered to be sort of good products, that products, and we want others to stop coming in and making things claiming they're the same thing. But geographic indications up to now haven't really been used, as far as I know, to build up that goodwill. In other words, they shouldn't have too high hopes about them, let's say.
Just on geographical indication, there's one thing to bear in mind is that it's actually quite difficult to get a geographical indication, and quite often the regulations ask for a traditional process, a history of process. You have to demonstrate a history of a similar use, and in there is a fair bit written about to what extent geographical indications are actually useful for traditional knowledge, and there's some who suggest that because traditional knowledge is somewhat might be different in one area than another, it actually could be quite difficult to get geographical indications on traditional knowledge, unless you have very specific products that have historically been used in one area
in a very similar way, in terms of the way of producing it seems to be quite important. Like, you could think like rooibos tea to some extent, you could think about some of that. So I think there's been for some time an over-enthusiasm to use geographically indicational traditional knowledge. It brings with it certain problems as well. So similar to some of the debate about to what extent existing IP models are suitable for TK protection also applies to geographical indication, and one has to look carefully about whether the conditions to get a geographical indication really match for the nature of traditional knowledge in the particular area.
It is a similar story also with trademarks. Now, I mean, there are a couple of examples I can think of in the UK, but one is Harris Tweed, which is a cloth made in northwest of Scotland. Right. Now, Harris Tweed is traditionally, right, in the past, it was made in people's homes, basically. It was made in people's homes in western Scotland, but there wasn't much else to do to make a living. Right. A very sort of sheep-oriented economy. The problem that arises is that it gets harder and harder to actually compete with products, with the mass producers, I think. And so the government, because it is a trademark, a certificate trademark on Harris Tweed, and which is with a nice logo, and it's very well marketed. And but in order to be able to compete, they had to upscale production, right? And so that would presumably make it no longer Harris Tweed, because it's partly factory made now. All right? And so there's the government passed an act, right, in order to define Harris Tweed to allow that third element of industrial production, and it's still called Harris Tweed. So there you have an act of parliament. So usually you think of trademarks as being basically the private rights, but sometimes, you know, you need a government to step in to pass the law in order to allow a certain flexibility in order to meet new markets or challenges, such as mass production from other parts of the world, or very similar sort of products. So, you know, while, you know, I think, you know, one of the attractions of trademark law is it keeps the government out, in a way. It's about private rights, commercial rights. Sometimes the government does have to sort of step in to make it work if we care enough for the small producers in isolated areas of Scotland, who without that would be, you know, being traditional in a very dogmatic way would put them out of business.
Fine.
Thank
you.
So just now we open the floor on questions on the amendment bill or on the presentation or on any specific point.
Thank you. Members, yes, on my left, now just to let you know what our time is looking like, we have 35 minutes to have both questions and responses. So, having said that, I would like to ask everyone to be mindful of that constraint. Yes, Mr. Oriani Ambrosini.
Okay, I can get the answer at lunchtime. I have a number of difficulties that I cannot put my mind around. If somebody can help me, and and they're technical difficulties, but they're so foundational and so fundamental that if unless they solve them, the entire thing doesn't work for me. The entire system of intellectual property protection is based on incremental element, which is novelty and usefulness. And so each new piece, we don't protect knowledge, we protect pieces of knowledge. And then each new piece comes on top and is defined by being new, has not been dealt with before, and by a claim, which creates a little box which goes on top of the other boxes. Now, the thrust of this operation is to go from the bottom. So it's not novelty, but it's antiquity that requires protection. It's traditional. It's already there. If it is novel, we deal with it. So it comes from the bottom. And how do we define it? And how do we link
what is at the bottom from what can then comes to the top. So there is a piece of pre-existing knowledge which is foundational, as in the chairman's example. We use the plant that we chew on the willow trees to get the headache go away, the aspirin of digitalis. And that's there. That's at the bottom. It's not definable, cannot have a claim. It's a habit. Then out of that, somebody needs to get at the top and synthesize a molecule which basically does the same as the extract from the willow tree. I cannot see how that operates within the IT system, because in this bill, if I read correctly, there is no process of defining the knowledge through a claim by means of innovation and with respect to prior existing knowledge. First question. The second question, Professor was, I think, asking the fundamental question, why are you doing this? And that's a question we must ask ourselves, because once we identify why we are doing it, then we need to identify what is the tool. And the fundamental fact is that this is a nationalization process. We take it away from the communities, we put it into the state, and as we put it into the state, we add value and we create this. The difficulty I have, which I expressed before, is that all knowledge belongs to mankind. Only in very special events we restrict knowledge and we create property around knowledge, and that until now has been to reward innovation, to reward scientific achievement, to create an incentive to create something new. The French Revolution came about breaking the monopoly of anyone who said it's mine because I know about it. So now we are creating property around that which by definition is not new. And I don't know whether we are trying to get a square peg into a round hole or vice versa if we use intellectual property. Thank you.
Right. Are there any more comments or questions on my left from members? Yes. Mr. Nicolana, is that yourself or myself?
Chair, mine is very brief and on a lighter note. Mansion is made of feta cheese. I only got exposed to feta cheese at an old age. And when I took a look at it, I said, I'm yingagali. Mm. I grew as a cause for eating yingaga. Now what do you say about that? I do not know how old it is. Fathers or whether Zulus and others have been eating yingaga, because feta cheese comes from curdling of milk. I'm just provoking that, because it's actually quite interesting, and I usually joke with friends, you know, even in Europe when I see feta cheese. But look, the angle from it I know. And I was just looking at article here saying the
get your mic on.
Yes, the political economy of intellectual property. A very interesting thing is made here by this person. He says stronger intellectual property rights will reinforce class differences, undermine science and technology, speed up corporatization of unions, inundate society's legal disputes, and reduce personal freedom. But all in all, he also further says it burdens the economy with expensive litigation and infringes. No, burdens the economy with expensive litigation. I'm just provocative with that. And
you know that?
I'll share it with you, Chase.
No, share it with everyone.
Yeah, it's Michael Perelman. It's a monthly review on political economy. It's an article. But what struck me is that, in your opinion, are our attempts trying their level best to actually, you know, care, preempt, or be proactive on this expensive litigation, if it's avoidable? Thank you.
Right. Mr. Albert.
Thank you. My question is a little bit more philosophical, but it comes down to the nitty-gritty of the implementation of the protections that we envisage. And it's about communities, the nature of communities. I want to make a statement. Nature is energy bonded, but communities, human communities, are information bonded. And as Mario has indicated, we want to protect certain forms of information. We want to draw regulatory protection around it. If we do that for the information itself, how does that relate to the protection of the communities themselves? Within the South African context, but also internationally. Internationally, taking into account various treaties regarding indigenous peoples, also minority rights, and then also coming back to South Africa, how this would gel with the constitution of South Africa in terms of its liberal nature, where it protects individuals and not so much groups as such, and how you would like to, or how you foresee to create a synthesis between these two philosophies. Because somebody can take this bill eventually to the Constitutional Court and say, but this is not on. This is contrary to the spirit of the Constitution, with its liberal nature that views individuals as the constituent members of society. I don't really agree with that completely. That's also not my party's view. That's why I'm asking this question. It's a difficult question. I understand that, but I think we need to think about that as well. Because at the end of the day, from my party's point of view as well, minority rights is very important in bringing a balance in modern democracies. And I believe we don't truly have reached that point in South Africa as yet. So if you're going to protect information, how do you also relate that and protect the information givers, those communities themselves, from a constitutional legal point of view? Thank you.
Yes, I have a question myself, that really relates to this issue of protection, which someone referred to as perhaps defensive protection, now that in the past there had been a different approach operating where people felt that things could be shared, and then they still remain the communities primarily until they realize, well, in this modern society, you've got to own your own things, as it were. You know, you've got to have that. One almost goes back to days when you didn't need a passport, you know, centuries ago. Now they say, no, you can't just travel around, you must have a passport, etc. Which, philosophically speaking, because I know Mr. Albert is also a philosopher, that, I do think a lot of this is being brought about by the Cartesian philosophy. Now, if we had a different one prevailing, as we do in African culture, as we do in other cultures, then, of course, we may not have locked ourselves into that. Having said that, and by the way, I've always had that view, I think that we really need to move away from that, and haven't got time to explain that view now, but that's over lunch. Is this issue, you know, we want a database, etc., and then we're going to have this all stored, reassured by the department, so that, we know who's got what and so on and so forth. Things will have to be registered. Now, what worries me, and I do want to comment on this, is perhaps the danger as well in the database, while I recognize we do need to establish one, is that what isn't in the database then isn't protected. You know, so you decline to go on the database, and now it's not. Secondly, it's not that you declined, you weren't aware that you should, because clearly when you bring in legislation of this nature, one needs to ensure that everyone from every corner knows about this. I mean, purely to use FIFA as an example,
we are so used to thinking that everyone can access TV, we perhaps even forget to realize in our own country, signals are not possible for TV in a number of parts and pockets in this country. So, you know, it's things like that that are worrying me. Does it mean because for some reason you never had that good fortune to hear about it, you know, I've lost it all? And I would like to know, I mean, clearly some people have tried to look into this and see, certainly when we did go overseas, I know WIPO kind of used the word grappling, and clearly they you know, hadn't reached any kind of a position on this from the 150 groups, and of course that is much more difficult. So if you would comment on that, and if the comment is going to be long, then by all means just share a little of it, and perhaps the rest over lunch.
Thank you. Okay, is there any more questions? Okay, we... Kevin? I'm going to quickly try and see if I can respond to some of the questions. One is the question that was raised about the idea of prior art, and I think the image that was presented was that there is knowledge and then there is new knowledge added, and that new knowledge is what seeks to be protected because it constitutes an inventive step. If one looks at the amendment to the Copyright Act itself, the Copyright Act of 1978, I mean, the bill seeks to amend it. What the bill is trying to do is to say, if it essentially seeks to establish the notion of group rights over intellectual property, over traditional works specifically. So here you've got a situation where it says, in 2010, after the bill comes to pass, if there is a traditional work that is developed, then it is eligible for a copyright. Okay? Or 50 years preceding that. But the point that it's trying to make is that it says that it is eligible for copyright, yes, but a group has a right over it. And because it is hard to kind of identify specific rights holders as far as that group is concerned, yes, the state will become the owner of that particular copyright. But the idea is that it is still looking at what is traditional knowledge, and it understands traditional as something that is highly dynamic in that sense. So it's not necessarily saying that something has to be 500 years old. It says 50 years from the date of 2010 or 50 years before that, you will get a copyright. But the point is that the copyright, at some level, is a result of the work that emerges from a group. But the state owns that particular copyright. So that's how it's looking at. So in one sense, the idea of the inventive step is that it is looking at the traditional work itself as something that is inventive. That is my understanding of the bill, and that's what the bill seeks to do. The second point is about the notion of the individual versus the notion of the group. The point that was raised about, at some level, it is a liberal constitution and we are talking about individuals here. The challenge when it comes to traditional knowledge is how does one construct the legal subject itself? Within the liberal rights discourse, you're talking about an individual at some level as an isolated unit or an atomistic entity that relates to other such individuals through a discourse of rights. But when you talk about the notion of communities, and in the context especially of indigenous people's rights and traditional knowledge, what you're talking about is that the construction of the individual is not a liberal conception of the individual. The self is constructed as a relationship. So at some level, if you're still talking about individuals, but individuals who define themselves as fundamentally relationships within communities. So you want to protect these kind of relationships. And these kind of relationships generate certain kinds of rights to sustain these kind of relationships. So ultimately, you're not essentially veering away from the South African constitution, but recognizing new forms of what does individuality actually mean.
Okay, and and lastly, yes, Madam Chair, that is an important question about what happens if it is not recorded in the database. Therefore, will it not be protected? And in one sense, yes. I mean, and there is a problem there. However, there is also the possibility of saying, fine, a copyright may not be there, and that copyright may not vest in the state. But if at some level it can be proved that this knowledge, on the basis of which someone seeks to get a copyright, has already been prior art, already existed, then you can challenge the inventive step of that particular person. So it doesn't have to be necessarily, it may have to be recorded in the database for the state to provide a copyright to that traditional work. However, the point still remains that if another person comes up who does not belong to the community and develops something and says, well, and it's fundamentally based on this traditional work and claims the copyright on it, the community is still open under the Conventional Copyright Act for that community to challenge, saying that, well, this was something that we have developed and it was always there. So there is that option. So I'll stop there as a response to these three questions, and my colleagues can add. Or thanks.
Thank you,
Kimir.
Graham,
is
there something you want to...
Okay, briefly, I mean, perhaps the reason why we're talking about this at all is that there's perception that IP is somehow sort of unfair, right, because it privileges certain ways of communicating information, it allows rights in certain works that are packaged in a certain way. So, for example, okay, so you can't have copyright in your traditional dance, but if you film it, you have a right in your recording. And so others come in and they film it. They go, they have a 50-year or whatever right. And that just, you know, that just doesn't seem fair. Nowadays, with patents, you can patent sort of new uses for old things. Is that reasonable or not? I mean, I would suggest that perhaps patenting new uses of old things is open to abuse, for one thing. And also, it's a biased version of novelty. So now, if we accept that, does it mean that the whole IP system has to be completely changed to allow completely, you know, sort of forms of creativity that, you know, fall outside the system should also be protected? Or alternatively, should we, okay, that's the way it is, and we'll come up with a completely sort of new system, right, to protect those things that IP cannot or will not accommodate. And that, in a way, is the sort of question, is a decision that you have to make, I think.
Thank you. I just may add that the question of the two aspects of the question, of the discussion, the question of creation of rights, and that goes back to the model that Kabir mentioned this morning, the question of creation of rights, attributing new rights to communities, how they are exercised, how they are defined. Again, as we have seen discussion, that is extremely complex, right? And what is the limit of these rights? How are they exercised, etc.? And that is why actually some countries have come and actually to the conclusion or have been thinking towards the tendency that this is it's much of a too complex exercise to engage in, right? Because there's such a variety of communities, such a variety of practices, etc. So what you should try to do is to focus more on what's called the defensive protection, right? Like the Indians are doing with the library of traditional knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Is to prevent really the claims on of ownership, right? But without still providing new rights to the subject matter. I mean, that is also an area of hesitation and that people are grappling with. I just want to see if Olivier or Joanna want to add anything or
I pretty much agree with what was said, that essentially that it would be useful to look at this act as a possibility of defensive protection, and then on top of that consider maybe the option of alternative approaches for a system of protection that is more suitably geared to traditional knowledge, and to do so
engage in a process of consultation, which what Professor Zetfield was talking about. Because essentially the question that you're raising in terms of how do we apply these patentability criteria, criteria for getting copyright, criteria for any sort of intellectual property, how does that really apply to traditional knowledge is really at the heart of this. I mean, can we therefore mend the system to something that would somehow pick up certain forms of traditional knowledge? It's kind of always the question that we're coming back to, and that's the key question that you basically have to ask yourself. And on top of that, of course, the issue of the models and the management of rights. What's the role of the state versus the community? Who's managing what? What are the rights of the community in this? How much is national ownership? How much is community ownership? These are kind of the, I would say, the two big bulks of questions that have been reoccurring over the last couple of days.
Kabir? Quickly, just perhaps an interesting bit of information when we're discussing the sui generis models. And a lot of this discussion came about, took place during the negotiations of the protocol on access and benefit sharing under the Convention on Biological Diversity. And it was very interesting because the African group negotiators, the bloc, as you know, and the African group of negotiators made a very, very interesting proposal. Because they asked themselves the question that when we're looking at these sui generis models for protection of traditional knowledge, why are we doing so? And the answer is, yes, because communities may have different systems of how knowledge is regulated and shared. And you want to, at some level, acknowledge these systems and, at some level, make sure that these systems are systems that govern how traditional knowledge is used and shared outside of these communities. And secondly, you want to secure the rights of these communities, which the convention says are owners of this kind of traditional knowledge relating to biodiversity. So one of the ways was that the interpretation of this particular article in the convention that recognizes community rights, that's Article 8J, is that communities have to give consent for the use of the traditional knowledge and they have to share benefits. But it is in this context that the African group of negotiators suggested this idea that came up as a result of a Pan-African meeting of indigenous and local communities here of community protocols. What the suggestion was this, that at some level, communities can come together or within a particular community that has developed and used certain kinds of traditional knowledge, and they can develop a protocol amongst themselves. This protocol is almost like an interface document. It's a document that lists out what are the customary norms and values of that particular community on the basis of which that knowledge has been used and shared, and at some level, what are the terms and conditions on the basis of which the community will share this knowledge with external stakeholders, and it could be you cannot use it for X, Y, Z reasons, you can only use it for this. So this community protocol then becomes a legal instrument that has been bottom-up developed by the community, which articulates its values and norms, and at some level has to be recognized by the state. Now, there are a couple of communities in South Africa that are in the process of developing their own community protocols and also other parts of Africa, Kenya and Ghana namely. And in India, again, a number of communities have now begun to develop these community protocols, which clearly lay down what are the terms and conditions for the use of their traditional knowledge, which are entirely rooted in the value systems of these communities. So in one sense, that's an interesting attempt at developing a certain kind of a sui generis model. The community creates the law for the use and sharing of traditional knowledge, and the state has to, at some level, give it legal validity outside the community's territories. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, we do have just a couple more questions.
Okay.
And I'm looking at the time. We've got 2 minutes. But mindful of that, Mr. Oriani Ambrosini,
yeah, I'll be very telegraphic. I'll try to, because the point just raised, I think, is foundational. The entire status of knowledge within communities at the present time within Africa, the little bit I know, if we look at the history of Western civilization, knowledge is secret. It's conveyed by initiation through initiates. There are mysteries, there are guilds, and it's all kept secret from those who do not belong to the trade, to the community, and elsewhere. To the best of my knowledge, there is no such notion of secrecy or proprietorship
of any type of knowledge within communities, save for perhaps some of the songs which are initiation songs. So we would be asking community to engage in an exercise which, at least within the South African context, is inherently foreign and inimical to the very culture of sharing what they know. There has never been, land and knowledge has been available to whoever wanted and the community next to it. But even if we walk that path, I need to think as a lawyer, and I can't help myself because we are looking at legislation. How do I identify the element of knowledge? Mendelssohn wrote the Gypsy Rhapsodies. In terms of this type of legislation, had it been in place, it wouldn't need to pay royalty to the gypsy. But what it is in Mendelssohn's Gypsy Rhapsodies which makes them gypsy? And what would have the gypsy required to have registered within the registry in terms of their own gypsy something that would have made it gypsy? More other example, the song of the Lion King, Ingonyama, it's Zulu, but what is it that makes it Zulu? And to many, Zulu might not even be recognized as Zulu, but it is portrayed as Zulu.
Okay, thank you. I'd really like to ask, particularly your last input that you have made, what are the tools that you advise out there on the very, very last input that you have made to countries? Because I hear what you say on the one side of, you know, what legislation can do, but in order to protect, my other question would then be, what are the drivers that you are being motivated by? Is it the fact that you need to protect for the sake of protecting, or is it because of, you know, any financial motivations? And then I obviously would like to know what are the push and pull factors that you consider in all of this. And then I'd also like to know, as I ask about the the tools. I didn't, you can assist me if I'm correct. I didn't hear any one of you talk about royalty as a, whatever you want to call it. I'm intrigued by this thing of royalty when you made the example of the cloth. The Harris Tweed. I was intrigued by that because in South Africa, a very, very big clothing company called Rex Trueform used to produce Lanvin, which is the Italian label, and then Dax, which is the London one. And royalty had to be paid to London and Italy. It's in that context that I'm asking. I don't hear any one of you talking about, other than just protecting when use enters, what do you suggest, and do you think royalties is a good idea in that instance? Thank you for the opportunity, Chair.
Right. Just to ensure we're all on track, you really only have 3 minutes.
Thank you. That's a challenge, Madam Chair. But what we suggest is that we will do a final round of comments on our side of ideas to each one of us, and we will get back to the floor to you at that point.
Olivier? Well, don't rush,
Senator. I'm trying to answer two questions at the same time, rather badly probably, but... well, the question of royalty and how closely or how distant the derivation should be in order for the right to sort of kick in and royalty pay or other to be required. I mean,
if I mean, in copyright, you have alternative works in the United States or in the UK, we have adaptations. And so there is a way of defining the distance between the original work, right, and the work that is encompassed within that monopoly. And so, so it has been worked out. But it might be that through sort of jurisprudence, a modus vivendi will be worked out.
Well, that's not my question.
Oh, okay.
Should we talk about
the life? But okay, go ahead.
No, I mean, I'm not asking for my sake. I ask for the sake of the process. So if I can get an answer to actually my
question. Well, we'll get it over lunch if we have to.
Can all your questions land up in lunch?
I'm not sure we have.
I'm only going to talk about him.
No, clearly there won't be a domination, but a shared lunch with the questions and responses. Ms. September, your question to be responded to then, is it?
Kabir, yeah. I'll just respond to your question because it's an outstanding one. The push-pull factors. What are the push-pull factors for something like this? Now, as I said, I mean, it always helps to kind of, in this case now, refer to the existing legislation in South Africa, which is the Biodiversity Act, which is now one way of kind of protecting traditional knowledge. At least the push-pull factors within the Biodiversity Act and how that's conceptualized is the fact that traditional knowledge needs to be conserved. Why traditional knowledge needs to be conserved is because this kind of traditional knowledge is critical for the conservation and sustainable use of biological diversity. In order for that to happen, there are two ways of doing this. And one is, of course, as you said, the issue of incentives. And that is essentially linked to this kind of idea of benefit sharing, where the model in South Africa is that if someone uses the traditional knowledge of communities for commercial or research, then at some level benefits have to be shared back with the community, and that is an incentive for that particular community to be able to conserve and sustain this kind of traditional knowledge which leads to biodiversity conservation. The other factor is rights. At some level, if communities have secure rights over their knowledge, innovations and practices, then at some level that itself becomes a way for them to conserve their knowledge. Because communities at some level, one of the reasons for loss of... Yes. Okay, so the point is rights and incentives. And these are in many ways the push-pull factors. Sometimes like the San community, they clearly wanted incentives. They said, we want something in exchange for our knowledge. And others just purely want rights, saying we want rights to be acknowledged and we don't want anyone to use it commercially.
Right. As I said, we have the president responding to questions sharp at 2. It takes us 5 minutes to get into the chamber. It takes us, I noticed, at least 5 minutes to get downstairs. So we do need to close now.
Okay, so I think we will close it. We will I think wrap up from our side and suggest. As you have seen, there's many issues to continue to be addressed, to be raised regarding this debate, regarding the bill itself, and we're happy to respond to those on an informal basis, as you wish and as you see appropriate. I end up just thanking you, Madam Chair, for inviting us to meet with the distinguished members of this committee. It's been a great privilege, and again, an honor for us. We hope there will be future occasions of interaction. I'd like also to thank Mr. Ermans, the Secretary of the Committee, who has greatly facilitated our participation. On my behalf, and I think on behalf of my colleagues, we want to thank you once more. You kindly referred to me during the discussion as the leader, and I'd like to just correct that, that this is not the case. I'm just a facilitator here of the participation of my colleagues. I mentioned Johanna played a very instrumental role in coordinating us all and in bringing us all together. I'd like to thank each one of them, Mr. Dutford, Mr. Bagbati, Mr. Rukundu, Ms. Ron Brown. I'd like to thank them, each one of them, because really they took away, they changed their schedules, they really went around to be here. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
At this point,
point, we have just a short gift there, a small little gift, more a token, so that you don't forget the South African art. So I'm going to be asking the four or five soldiers to wander down there, and then we also ask Arthur, Connie from Timber, Hans from Elvis, Mr. Quiver.